It's Tuesday, January 2nd, 2018, Masoret. All right, so we're taking up something in Vayechi pertaining to the one of the first subjects in Vayechi is the oath that Yaakov solicited from Yosef. And that's a question, whether what exactly did he utilize the oath for? There's also a question as to why. But it pertained to two things, it would appear. If you take a look at the Parsha in Vayechi, that's in 47, Mem Zayin, when... Well, first it begins by telling us that Yaakov lived in Eretz Yisrael for 17 years. And the days of Yaakov, the years of his lives, were 147. All right, so he, interestingly enough, I don't know what exactly you can deduce from that, is that he lived the shortest lifespan of the Avos. Significant, I would say significantly shorter, because Avram lived till 175, and Yitzhak lived till 180, and Yaakov lived till 147. Of course, it's tempting to make the connection between the travails. It would seem, of the three Avos, that he had the most difficult times, the most difficulties. I think that that's fairly obvious. I don't think that's a very controversial point, because the Torah does present the lives of all three. Okay, it's not a biography, but it does recount the essential happenings. And with Yaakov, from the point at which he's forced to leave home until the point where he goes to Mitzrayim, he goes through a tremendous amount of difficulties and sufferings and so on and so forth, which we've enumerated before. Now, whether that's the cause of his quote-unquote younger demise or earlier demise, that's speculation. It's interesting, though, the Chazal do say that with regard to Yosef. I believe Rashi brings it down, that Yosef died the youngest. He was next to the youngest of the brothers, and he was the first of the brothers to die. And there they do make the point that it is that concept of malchus, that being a leader, being a king, being a president, and so forth, shortens your life. So they make the point with regard to that. That's, I don't know that that is part of the Masorah, but that was their understanding, and this was an illustration of it. I'm not sure exactly what modern... I think the modern medicine agrees. I think the idea... To the contrary, I think the idea of mental stress playing a role in one's longevity, one's health in general, I think that's pretty much established today. That...
They always show photos of the presidents before the term and after the term, how badly the term in office ages them.
Well, yeah, that's an excellent point. I know. Just take a look at the pictures of, and we're just talking 8 years. Take a look at Bush when he started his presidency and how he looked towards the end. All right, it's just 8 years. I don't know if it's attributed to that. And the same thing with Obama, who he looks very young when he starts, but he definitely aged in the process. I don't know if it's by, we don't know about the Trump, but it's not going to be a good example because he's already older. He enters the presidency at about the age of 70. So that's the point of time that a person, the natural forces, will cause a person to age. The aging process accelerates. A stressful position, and I think you have to agree with this, the point is being made, and it's well taken, that stress will have an effect upon a person's health and certainly upon the aging process. But you have to add a qualification, and that is that not everybody responds to stress in the same way. The stress of high office, responsibilities, and so on and so forth. I mean, you see, there are certain people that lived to ripe old ages. I take Winston Churchill. I think that a lot of it has to do with the way the person responds to it. People respond to stress differently, and a certain type of personality. That is, there are people that really like it. To the contrary, they suffer without it. They need that. They need the excitement, the exhilaration, the challenge. And they don't aggravate. I think a lot of this has to do with the extent of the aggravation. It brings a tremendous amount of aggravation. And, you know, the person would just prefer not to have that and peace and quiet, or he's hurt by the criticism. Because no matter what it is, I don't care how great you are, you're going to have your critics. Just by virtue of being in that position, I don't care if you're a popular president. Reagan was a popular president. He was very popular, Obama, but he had people that couldn't stand him. And that's going to be true of everybody. I mean, Bush, you know, he had a tremendous amount of opposition. And it's not just that, it's the way they berate you and put you down and talk about it. Because today there's no respect. So whether this will happen with Trump, I have my doubts, because I think he just loves what he's doing. I don't think he suffers that way. Somebody once wrote about him, he doesn't have the gene for shame. I'm making a moral judgment about him at all. But he just, no matter what happens, and no matter how bad it is or embarrassing it might be, it doesn't seem to bother him. He doesn't have the same response. He very, very hardly ever apologizes or acknowledges that he did anything wrong. And I'm just saying that I think he loves the I don't know if it's the position. I don't think he cares about the position. I think he just loves to be in charge. It fulfills his nature. It's in line with his nature. He's a leader. He's a natural leader. And you can see he's not afraid to lead. He's not afraid to make decisions. Again, they could be good or bad. That's not what I'm talking about. And I think Churchill was a person like that. So there are people that do thrive on leadership. So you have to know how to, you know, so when Chazal say that, you see by Yosef that it shortens a person's life, that's true, but it's not an absolute. All things being equal, it's good. Most people suffer under the stress. And I think that while they may miss the glory, there are certain people that miss the glory of it, there's a sense of relief. I don't think, for example, like a person like Bush would want to get back in there. I don't get that sense. Because it's a big fantasy. Everybody wants being the president. All the glory, all the honor, and so on and so forth. And I think he made the same point, Obama, that you get over that very quickly. Because at first, you know, there's nothing more greater. You're the center of the universe, and the White House, and Air Force One, and all of that. And while people fantasize about that and what it would be like, but it's true, the actuality is you get used to it. And it doesn't give you that same thrill anymore. So you wake up every day after a while. You live in the White House, so what? And you're flying on Air Force One, so what? To us it seems great because we have to fly with, you know, by regular airline and the wait on lines and all that stuff. But like it's an important lesson. It's a very, very important lesson. Now, no matter how fantastic something seems, you know, the most beautiful houses are over the water or this, luxuries, the most beautiful luxuries in the world that really grab you are nothing but fantasies, and were you to attain them, you would get used to them very, very quickly, and they would cease to provide any happiness at all. Interesting. Now, okay, so let's getting back to the point over here. So, oh, as far as I was making the point, as far as Yaakov is concerned, it therefore is legitimate to make the point that there is an association between the shorter lifespan that he had did not reach the age of his father and grandfather. There's with the fact that he did have a lot of what we'd call agmas nefesh, and you see because in addition to the practical problems that he faced in dealing with Esav and dealing with Lavan, but he also had sons. I mean, once you have them, and it was from different mothers, so that also is a very, very complex situation. Had to deal with that, and they weren't easy, you know, easygoing people. That were, you see all the conflict that they were into, and then the conflict he had with them with regard to Shechem, that they went contrary to his understanding of what should be done. They mishandled the situation, and he did not get the last word until the brachos. Interesting brachos, because it didn't seem like a bracha for Reuven, it didn't seem like a bracha for Shimon and Levi. But that's a separate topic. But I would say like this, if we're going to bring that in, that factor in, and talk about the fact that the mental sufferings or aggravations that a person has can shorten his life. That all the things that we have mentioned would not be the biggest of them. Which one would you say would be the biggest of them? See Yosef. That's what I would say. And that's what Yosef asked, Ha'od Avichai, is my father still alive? That is, that he was able to survive the apparent loss of Yosef is, that itself is miraculous, given the nature of the relationship and how special Yosef was to him in every which way, and that he did give credence to the dreams that he would be emerge as the leader of the family, and then the future was vested in him, and that this could happen to him. He said, I'll go down to my grave mourning. That, I would say, there's no it's the aggravation, as we've said. It's not the challenges themselves, it's how a person reacts to them. So people that really enjoy being involved in these decisions and challenges and so on and so forth, so for them it's a good thing, given that they have the disposition, they don't aggravate. I mean, a person like Truman was like that. He made the most monumental decision in history to drop an atom bomb. And not one, but then since they didn't surrender, he dropped another one. And that's a very unusual kind of person to just make a decision like that. And he said he didn't lose any sleep that night, did not lose any sleep. So we're not going into the policy itself. He had his reasons. That's an amazing kind of a quality that I admire in people. I don't know about all people. I mean, assuming that the person is making, because the ability to make a decision and have a certain confidence, and that's it, and don't look back and tear you and beat yourself up. I know a lot of people that beat themselves up, and even if you did whatever you could do, there are people, however, that, I don't mean reckless people, people that act, you know, prudently, do the best you could do, and that's it. And if the thing went wrong and they made a mistake, well, what can I do? I tried, you know, I did what I had to do, so I made a mistake. They don't beat themselves up. That's an amazing quality to have. Not everybody has it. Whether one can train oneself, I think that with a discipline, mental discipline and training, you could put yourself more in that, because when you think about it, there's so much energy that's wasted. It's not the same. In other words, if you haven't made the decision, So that, and you should be looking into it more. So that's a good thing. You should be impelled. Don't make reckless decisions. But if you have done all that you can do, and it turned out not perfectly or whatever, or badly, so then you have to, there's a time when you have to do tshuva because you did things wrong or you were too lazy or whatever, but then there's a time where you did everything right, to the best of your ability, obviously. And that there's no gain, there's no benefit, there's no reason to subject yourself to that. And that could be, people that have that habit of beating themselves up are much harsher on themselves than others, outsiders. So that's not a good thing. Let's put it, definitely that's not a good thing. And I'm just saying this, not that seriously, but people make New Year's resolutions. So this is a good one to put on your list. And we don't go into that because we deal from the framework of Rosh Hashanah and Shuvah and all that. I'm just using this to get the point that it's not a bad thing to have on your list of things you're going to work on. Not to inflict unnecessary mental duress on oneself. That's a good time. Anybody will dispute that. The suffering that he had pertaining to Yosef. And that's got to be something that he would feel guilty over. Because he'd have to review everything that was done in terms of did he intervene? Did he handle it properly? He was there. And that he was there. And, I don't know about mishandling it. He didn't intervene. He didn't handle it properly. And then he tried to step in and to no avail. It was too late. It was too late when he rebuked Yosef by that time. So I think that adds to it. The fact that something terrible happened, the loss of Yosef, and the fact that, there's a lot for you to think about. Your own participation, your own guilt about not handling it correctly and not assessing the extent of the hatred of the brothers, because he did send Yosef out on that day. So that could be a factor. Okay, let's proceed now. Then it tells us that he Vayikru Yimei Yisrael Lamas, and he came, his days were coming to an end. And he called to his son Yosef. See, so it's interesting that there's two time periods over here in which the Torah says that he's coming close to dying. You have this, and then he calls Yosef, and then he takes care of the business with Yosef, soliciting the oath, and then Yosef goes back to wherever he would go. Then, if you go ahead to chapter 48, it says that Vayhi Achrei Hadvar Me'ela, it was after these things, Vayomer Yosef, and he said to Yosef, or it was said to Yosef, doesn't say, someone said to Yosef, okay, Hine Avicha Chola, behold your father is sick. And then he took his two sons, Menashe and Ephraim, and he went to Yaakov, and that's the point at which Yaakov blessed Menashe and Ephraim. So it's interesting because the parsha begins by saying that is, what's the difference between the first instance and the second? In the first instance, it says that his days were close to dying. And then it says that, okay, then that's over. Then it was after these things, then he became sick. So what's the connection between the two? What's the difference between the first and the second? So I would say in the first instance, I guess there's two time periods. And that is that, well, you see that Yaakov faced the reality of death. Because a person can sort of sense within himself. He sort of sensed that he was coming to the end. There's enough signs, you know. I don't know exactly. It doesn't describe for us what he could, you know, what abilities he may have lost and so on and so forth. But he had a clear sense that he was reaching the end. That's the first, that is the first instance. See, when his days came close to dying, he wasn't on his deathbed yet. Doesn't mean that he was going to die any minute. But he was close. I don't know, I guess a few months or something like that. It's kind of like the doctors, when a person has a certain severe form of cancer, they give him a few months to live. So, that's when his days come close to dying. However, it doesn't mean it's imminent. Then you have the period of time in which he's dying. And then it's imminent. When he became chole, when he became sick, that's his final illness. He still was able to do things. In other words, because that's when he makes the arrangement with Menashe and Ephraim. That's when he does the blessings and so forth. But kind of right after the brachos, that's when he dies. So that's the final illness. Okay? This is just in the time period where he knows that he doesn't have much longer. He's coming close to dying. Okay. So then he solicits the oath from Yosef. It would seem that there were two elements. One was Al Nosik Birani B'Mitzrayim. Please do not bury me in Egypt. Then it says V'Shachafti Mavosai. And when I die, basically that means when I die, and you shall carry me from Egypt and bury me in their burial place. And those are the two things. Are they two separate things or are they one thing? Because it would seem if the plea is to bury me in the Maris HaMachpelah, so obviously don't bury me in Egypt. So it would seem then, if that's the case, that it's a little bit redundant. Why do you have to mention two things? Why not simply say that when I lie with my fathers, you shall carry me from Egypt and bury me in their burial place? And he said, I shall do as you say. And then he says, Ishavali. It's interesting. That's also interesting because you would have thought that first he would mention the oath. Here, he doesn't do it that way. He asks him. He does say to place your hand beneath my groin. That was the manner in which that would signify an oath. Okay? But first he agrees. Then he tells him to swear to me. Vayishavalo. And then it says that he bowed. So if Yosef already agreed to do it, what was the reason for the shvua? We took that up many times. I think that there's two basic answers. Apparently, this wasn't such a simple thing. You'd think that this is not a big deal. I mean, this is his father, and Yosef is his loyal son, and he's going to bury him, and he's going to honor, he'll bury him where he wants to be buried. That's generally speaking the way it works in all families. That if arrangements were made, or if it was clear to the children that this is where the parent wanted to be buried, that's pretty much what they're going to do. Assuming, obviously, that it's possible. So therefore, you have to assume that it wasn't a simple matter for Yaakov to achieve this. He realized that it would be difficult. And we could see from the subsequent description why that's the case. And the reason is because at that point in time, Yaakov was extremely prominent. An extremely prominent personality. Maybe even more so than Yosef. Because Yosef, of course, at that point in time. Although his stature, as the years go by after the famine, the stature of Yosef begins to recede. But that has to happen. But it was because of Yosef. Yosef was an unbelievable hero to the Egyptians as a result. I mean, his story was amazing. We don't look at it that way because, you know, you read it in the Chumash, it doesn't really present. You can get it from the Chumash, you know, comes out of jail, he interprets. Can you imagine with today's media? I mean, the whole world would be hanging on every move. You know, this prisoner who was serving in jail because of charges of rape against a prominent Egyptian's wife. And then he's removed from jail and he interprets the dreams. And then he suddenly becomes appointed to high, you know, the whole unfolding of every aspect. And he's going around in the king's chariot. Every aspect of the story. And then, of course, as the, all of his prophecies could start to come true. The 7 years of prosperity and so on and so forth. And the way he arranges things throughout Egypt. And then, of course, you have the story of the when the family comes down and he introduces Yaakov to Paro. So Yaakov has all of this, you know, prestige, his glory. He's the father of Yosef. In addition, he's sort of an ancient individual. Like, that's the first question that Paro asks him. How old are you? So for all of these reasons, and Yosef clearly told him that that he's like the wisest person. He probably told them more about his grandfather Yitzchak and Avram, where he comes from, but see, if you respect, I mean, if you respect someone, let's say, for example, if Einstein talks about a physicist that came here from a different country, and he tells them that if you think, I know physics, I know nothing compared to this person, he's the man. So that person gets a tremendous amount of the glory. So, therefore, because he had the reputation of being such a prominent individual, they're not going to want to let him go. They want to hold on to him, and they're going to want him to be buried in Egypt. That's a very delicate matter. Very, very delicate matter. Because national pride. It's a very significant thing, national pride. And a country takes pride in its great and prominent world-renowned personalities. So the idea of not being buried there is like almost like an insult. The Rav writes in one of his, I don't have it exactly where, about the fact that there was a whole to-do that the Rothschilds were big supporters of the Zionist movement. They gave a lot of money and so on and so forth. So when he died, he was in France. He lived in France. So I think maybe he was buried in France, but when the State of Israel was established, they wanted to reinter him, you know, with great Jewish Zionist heroes. And de Gaulle was opposed because Rothschild was a Frenchman. The fact that he's not buried in France, then he's not a Frenchman. So that's a big thing for a country. I mean, you have Arlington National Cemetery, you know, where the heroes are buried, where Washington is buried, where this one is buried. That's very, very significant. If they would choose to be buried somewhere else for whatever reason, it would be a big loss to the whole heritage of the country. So that's why, eventually, though, they were able to, you know, get the French to allow them to remove Rothschild and rebury him in Israel. I'm just using that as an illustration. So Yaakov realized that it would be not a simple thing. And there'd be a big question. Why? He came here. And he came here to escape from the famine. And he settled over here. See, I think it's very important also, because it's funny, he lived there for 17 years, but we say in the Haggadah that Yaakov did not go down there l'hishtakeyasham, to settle himself there. El logersham bovad, just to sojourn over there. Yeah, but what do you mean sojourn? 17 years is not a sojourn. It's true that it's... Because, you know, the Rambam uses that expression when he talks about that it's an avera. It's a sin for a Jew to live in Egypt to this day. To this day. You're not allowed to move to Egypt, to live there. Yet we know that, well, there aren't any more, but there was, the Rambam actually lived in Egypt. And there were Jewish communities there for thousands of years. Until the present day, you know, when you had the whole hostility with the Zionists and so forth. There might be a couple of Jews left in Egypt, but very few. I would say that what the Rambam does say that you can go there for business. Because you're going there sort of like on a temporary basis. Temporary, permanent is not necessarily viewed in terms of time. That is, when Yaakov went down there, he just went down, it was circumstances that forced him to be there, but his mental attitude was not, he never regarded himself as an Egyptian. He never regarded himself as an Egyptian. Thus, his idea was that as soon as it's possible, he's going to leave. And I think that the fact that he wasn't buried there is very, very crucial. Because had he been buried, in other words, among the various reasons why he did not want to be buried there, so that's perhaps why it's two separate things. It's not just that he wants to be buried in the Maris HaMachpelah. That's the ideal. But if that can't be arranged, he doesn't want to be buried there. Because being buried there changes the entire character of his, stay. Then it's not a sojourn anymore. Now, it is true, that you'll say, but Yosef was buried there, and all the other brothers were buried there. So, if that's the case, if being buried there is sort of a demonstration that this is my place, that I'm a citizen of this place, then why did they allow themselves to be buried there? Why did Yosef allow himself to be buried there? Anybody? In spite of the fact that, in terms of the nation itself, Yaakov, it would be viewed as more significant. He's one of the patriarchs. And his being buried in Egypt would have a worse impact, so to speak. But the question still is valid. Because they, the 12 sons of the 12 tribes, they're also very, very significant. But yeah, two factors, I would say. One factor is simply, from the fact that Yosef was buried, this reflects back and shows you why Yaakov needed to get a shvuah from Yosef, an oath from Yosef, because you see how difficult it was. Because by Yosef already, nobody could arrange that. For Yosef not to have been buried there would have been unacceptable. First of all, there was nobody in a high position anymore. Yaakov had Yosef to rely on because Yosef still had his high position. But nobody else, Yosef didn't, none of the brothers had a high position. So there'd be nobody that could advocate, except for the brothers would go to Paro, but on what basis? Now, you can imagine that Paro would be outraged, because it's different. It's different. With Yaakov, Yosef could say that that's where he lived. For 130 years, he lived in Canaan. He was only here for 17 years. And he came down because of the famine, and he wanted to see me. And because of the famine. So that dilutes the blow. So it's not an insult. It's not an insult to Egypt. That's the fine line that he had to walk. It's not an insult to Egypt. But there's other very good reasons why that's the place where he lived his whole life. He was part of Canaan society. Not to mention that to ordinary people, the idea of being buried in the family plot, that's the place where his grandfather carved it out, and his Sarah is buried there, and so on and so forth. That's also a compelling reason. But in the case of Yosef, what are they going to say? He was an Egyptian. What are you saying? He's not an Egyptian? He came down. He was 17. He had no life in Canaan. His whole life is Egyptian. Everything that happened to him happened over here. Here he matured into an adult. Here he obtained his position. Here he was appointed by the king. So what's your basis? That would have been the answer would have been no, but the very fact that they made the request would have been insulting. So it's not the same thing. Moreover, Yosef did express the fact that he did not view Egypt as his permanent place, because Vayashbaz Echav, he established the oath. He established the oath that when God removes you, you'll take my bones with you. And then all the brothers, realizing the significance of this, so who was the oath? Who took the oath? Every generation took the oath. It was a national oath. Actually, I write about that in the book, if you haven't read it. Well, the significance of mentioning that Moshe took the bones of Yosef. That's brought in. My question is, why is that brought into the context of the story of the Exodus? Why is it so important that it's mentioned over there? Okay, it's important, but why is it mentioned in terms of the Exodus? That's the question that I ask over there. The expression of the fact that this was a significant thing. That not being buried in Egypt was a significant thing. We see that from Yosef and the brothers as well. So that's why Yaakov, I'd say for two reasons, Yaakov solicited the oath. Because oath is very significant. You should be very careful with it. It's a double-edged sword because it has great seriousness. When a person takes an oath, he's bound in terms of his whole relationship with Hashem to do this action that he swore to. To break an oath is like a chilul Hashem. So therefore, there's a difference. Because sometimes somebody asks you for a favor, a difficult favor, and you're willing to do it for him because, for whatever reason, you owe him, he helped you, or you just want to help him, and all of that. So you're going to tell, I am going to do my very, very best to help you. That's not the same as with an oath. I'm going to do my very, very best, but then, yeah, there's a certain amount of commitment there and dedication, but it's not absolute. There's wiggle room. So, I mean, if the going gets really, really tough and difficult, so I tried. What could I do? But if you take an oath, there's really no excuse. You're going to do it, no matter what. You're going to do it. Because it's not between me and you anymore. It has to do with my relationship with God, because I swore by God, as God lives, I'm going to do this. So you don't want to be in a position where you're sort of denying that God exists. So, if it's something that is very, very difficult, which Yaakov realized that it was, then the fact that he's fortified by the need to keep his oath becomes significant. Now, actually, the Ramban doesn't learn that way. The Ramban is saying, I guess this is one, you know, you could raise a question. The Ramban is saying that with a person like Yosef in his relationship with his father, there's no, he didn't need the oath. This was a matter that was so significant to him to fulfill the will of his father in this matter that it wouldn't make a difference if he had an oath or not. And there are things like that. There are things that pertain, if something, God forbid, happens to your child, this needs all kinds of care, and you're going to have to go to the ends of the earth to find the right time. You'll do it. You don't need an oath. I mean, just like if it was yourself. If any person had a condition, a really serious condition, it was life-threatening, and, you know, it was, you had to uproot everything and go to the ends of the earth in order to get the proper care, so you would do it. You don't need an oath when it comes to things like that. So the Ramban says a different factor, and he says it wasn't for Yosef. It wasn't because he did not have the full confidence that Yosef would not do everything that he possibly could. But rather, it was for the sake of Paro. That is, he understood the mentality. Again, it fits into what we're saying, that he recognized that there would be tremendous resistance. And Yosef, and also, see, he didn't want to, there's another factor too. It's not just that it's, there's resistance, but it could leave a lingering resentment. Whether it did or didn't, we don't know. Because you see, with de Gaulle was resentful. He was upset. That bothered him. Rothschild's a Frenchman. So why doesn't he want to be buried here? So it could create a problem, a diplomatic problem. Why? Which would be with regard to Yosef. Why are you doing this? So Yosef needs a very compelling reason. So the compelling reason, well, I know my father, and he would have wanted it this way, and so on and so forth. That would be very, very hard. Why would he have wanted it? Egypt is a beautiful place. We treated him with such dignity. So he needed to come before Paro. Then the answer of the Ramban makes perfect sense. Fits in with the entire, principle here. And that is that he thought it through. On what basis do you want to say, why can't you bury your father over here? And even, okay, so the burial place of the fathers, that was their country, that's where they lived, but he came to Egypt. We became his country. So the fact, he couldn't just say, I know my father, I know that's what he would have wanted. And not even to say that he left the request. But he made me swear. So you see that the fact that he solicited an oath, well, two things. First of all, you see how important it was to him. That was extremely important to him. We have to honor his will. And secondly, if I don't do it, I'm not keeping my oath. I have to keep my oath that I made to my father. So those things, those types of things are very compelling to people, ordinary people. So that's the reason for the oath. Okay. Now, the next episode. In the next episode is when he's actually dying. He's quote unquote on his deathbed. And that's actually what I was going to get into. We'll take up the bulk of it tomorrow. So after the, I'm not going to take up the initial blessing that he gives to Menashe and Ephraim. And he establishes each one of them as a tribe. Each one of them has the status of a tribe. So in other words, really, it's just Yosef. Yosef is one tribe, but Yosef will now be counted as two. There is no tribe of Yosef anymore. It's rather Menashe and Ephraim becomes the tribes. That's basically what he does. And then you have the switching of the hands and all of that. Okay. Then.
I have a question about that. I don't know if you want to discuss it now.
What's that? It's interesting that he doesn't. After he finishes with making this new arrangement. And he says, Ephraim and Menashe, Keruven and Shimon Yuli, will be like Reuven and Shimon. In other words, each of them will be like a separate tribe. Umolaratecha, and any further children that you have after them will be yours. And their inheritance will be included in their brother's name. Okay. Now, from verse 7 and on. Verse 7 and on is, it seems to be coming out of nowhere. And he starts talking about what happened and why it is that he did not bury Yosef's mother, Rachel, in the Maariv HaMachpelah. Okay. It's Wednesday, January 3rd, 2018. Masoret. All right, so we're taking up the account in Vayechi of the death of Yaakov and what he did immediately prior to that. And we were talking about his request of Yosef, more than just a request. He made him take a shvuah, an oath, that A, he wouldn't bury him in Mitzrayim, and B, he would bury him in the Maariv HaMachpelah. Now, there's an interesting pasuk. After he forswears him, whatever the word is for causing someone to take an oath, then it records. So that's phase one. As we said, that's the time when he's not actually dying, but he's close. He realizes that essentially, you know, his life is basically over. It's just a matter of time. Then the final illness sets in. And that's when he calls Yosef. Yosef brings his sons. And then, you know, he makes the arrangement as how they will fit into the system of the tribes. And then he has the he gives them the blessings. And all these were given, as they say, on his deathbed. And after he makes the arrangement with regard to Manasseh and Ephraim, so it seems that this is a strange statement. That would be in 48, that's Memches, verse 7, Zion. And he says, Vani, Bavoi Mipadan, when I came from Padan, he's referring to the journey back to Canaan from Padan Aram, where he had stayed for around, I don't know, around 20 years or so under Laban. So he says, Mesa Alai Rachel. Literally, Rachel died Alai, died on me. Strange expression. Yeah, well, people use that expression when, you know, something happens that affects them in a significant way. They'll, you know, he got sick on me, meaning, you know, let's say even if you went on a trip with someone and you were counting to go all kinds of, you know, different places and the person got sick. So you'd say, he got sick on me. It's kind of like, it doesn't mean you're angry, it's just expressing the fact that it kind of messed things up for you. That's not the sense over here. But I'm saying that expression of on me, you know, we use in that kind of context when it affected you in a certain way. Generally negative. Of course, when he says Olai over here, the sense in which he means it is in terms of it was his loss. It was a big loss. He wasn't expecting this to happen because, you know, she had children. She was young. Rachel was young, and there was Yosef to consider, and then she had Binyamin. And, yeah. Well, by the way, there is a chazal. There is a statement in the rabbis that says, Ein isha meis ela labala. A woman doesn't die except to her husband. So, you know, that's their style, that's their method. It means that the essential, when somebody dies, generally there's an essential loss. There could be a loss on many levels. There's different levels, member of the community or even a friend, whatever. But generally, the person has a special relationship, well, could have more with more than one, but with at least one person, they really experience the loss. It's different. For them, it's a loss in a much more concrete way. So that's the case with Yaakov, that it was his loss. And I mean, he's also talking over here, he's bringing in the factor of the burial, because that's what he's talking about. And it was all upon him. Everything was on, you know, he had the full responsibility for all the children and for the sheep and all the people that were with him. So he says, Be'eretz Canaan baderech, in the land of Canaan, while we were, baderech means on the road. All right. Be'od kivras eretz lavo efrasa. When there was a certain distance, I guess a short distance to Efrat, ve'ekbere Hashem b'derech Efras, and I buried her there on the way to Efras, he Beis Lechem, which is Beis Lechem. Then he goes on to a different topic. And then it's Vayar Yisrael b'nei Yosef v'yom mi'ela. Then he asks, who are these? The sons of Yosef. So this pasuk, what's the point of it? What's he trying to say? And is the point that that Yosef didn't know this? This took place. I mean, it's not that this took place after Yosef was sold. This took place beforehand. So Yosef certainly knew about it. So what's the point? Yosef knew about this, where his mother was buried. And like I said, the pasuk seems completely out of place. So let's take a look at Rashi. V'ani b'voi mipadan. So Rashi says, V'yaf al pi shani matriach alecha l'holicheni l'kaber b'eretz Canaan, and even though I'm putting a burden upon you to transport me to be buried in the land of Canaan, v'lo kach asisi limcha, and I didn't do the same for your mother, shaharei meisa samach l'beis lechem, because she died close to beis lechem. So Rashi is saying that it's connected to what took place previously. By the way, I'm just glancing at the Sforno, and he says Mesa alai Rachel, and he says Kaomram zechron lebracha, as they, meaning Chazal, have said Ein isha Mesa el labala. He quotes that statement. I hadn't seen the Sforno before. At the Sforno, I'm sorry, if we take a look at the Eben Ezra, and V'tam v'ani b'vom mipadan, the reason for this pasuk, Shemesa pitom, she died suddenly, v'lo yecholti l'holicha l'kavra b'amara, and I wasn't able to take her. He's learning pretty much the same way as Rashi. I wasn't able to take her, to bury her, in the Miaras HaMachpelah, Kasheh Kavarti Leah, as I did bury Leah. Now, V'yamazel Yosef, and he said this to Yosef, Shlo Yichar Lach, you shouldn't be angry, Shavakesh Me'itcha, Mashalo Asisi, L'chvodi Mecha. That I'm asking you to do something that I did not do for the kavod of your mother. Rashi, the Rashi Va'ek Bereho Sham, and I buried her there. Below lachtia afil lebeis lechem lachnisa laaret, and I didn't even transport her even to beis lechem, which is a little bit difficult because the pasuk says that it is beis lechem to bring her into the land. I mean, so Rashi is implying that he didn't bury her in the land. That's what the Ramban has an issue with him. The Yadati Sheyesh Belip Cholai. See, Rashi is slightly different than the Evan Ezra, because Rashi is saying more, and I know that it bothers you, or that you have issues about this. Aval da lecha, but you should know, shal pi hadibur kvar tia sham, that I did this al pi hadibur. In other words, I did this by the word of God. Shitehe liezra levaneh, that she should be of assistance to her descendants, her sons. Kishya yagla osam nevuzradan, when nevuzradan of Bavel would exile them. Vayu ovrim derech sham, and they passed by the way there. Yatos Rachel al Kibra. So Rachel comes, that's the way it's put, that Rachel comes out of her kever, ubocha, and cries, umavakeshes aleihem rachmim, and she requests mercy for them. Shenemar, it says, kol barama nishma, a voice is heard in Rama. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Meshiva, and God answers her, Yesh Sachar Lepulasech. There's a reward for your efforts. Noam Hashem, says God, V'shavu Banim L'Gvulam. And the children will return to their boundaries. Okay. So, that's the essence. We don't have to go through the entire Rashi, but that's the essence of the just give me a second. Analyze it. Let's take up the Sephorno and see how he learns. But derech biyod kivra seres lo avrela. Tekef kishenasati meoso amakom shahaya dvar hakel yisbarach elai baodi baderech terem higii lebeis lechem. Okay, so they're all pretty much learning the same way, that she died suddenly. Suddenly, unexpectedly, and it was in a bad place. He was on the road. V'yekbareh Hashem b'derech Ephras. V'kol kach gavra alai tirdasi v'av lusi, and I was so overcome by the whole burden and the mourning. Shelo atzarti koach lo licha leveis kvaras beis lechem. And he said he didn't have the strength to take her to the Beis Kfaros. He's learning, it seems, a little bit differently, that it's not a matter of taking her to the Ma'ara, but he didn't even take her to the regular cemetery. Hold on a sec. Okay, so we're reading the Sforno, according to the translation of Rabbi Pelkowitz. So he says, and I buried her there in the way to Ephrath. So intense was my grief that I had not the strength even to carry her to the cemetery in Bethlehem. From that moment on, all physical desire left me, and I no longer cohabited with my wives. Well, that's what he says, cohabited with my wives. But the Hebrew wording is that he didn't have any strength to have children. I guess that's the way Rabbi Pelkowitz chose to translate it. All right, so yes. What we see over here is that the Sforno took a completely different path than the Evan Ezra and Rashi, because for them, the purpose of the entire thing and the context of the entire thing has to do with his request. And they're assuming, I mean, the way they're learning that is that Yaakov was concerned that he was asking for something that might arouse a certain resentment in Yosef, and therefore he had to explain. He had to explain it to Yosef so that he shouldn't have any type of resentment. But the Sforno is not learning that way. I mean, bear in mind that this might have been more appropriate when he made the request of Yosef, and then he said, Hishavali. So logically, if he was really concerned, don't you think he should have communicated that beforehand and then make the request? But now he's already made the request. And Yosef has agreed. So there's no, it doesn't seem like there's any need. What's the problem? That's my question. All right. That's my sense of things. I find it difficult to believe that Yosef actually had these issues. There's nothing that would indicate that. I mean, they had this close relationship, Yaakov and Yosef, and until that fateful time, he was the favorite. Yosef was the favorite, and he made him the special garment. And I mean, the love that Yosef had for his father, I mean, that was the most powerful thing. And this is after all those years. It describes the reunion. He personally put his chariot together, harnessed the animal, and rode out to meet his father. And he, Vayevk al Tzavar Tzavar Avod, and he cried on his father's shoulder. Okay, I'm not, look, you can still, that doesn't, one doesn't nullify the other. I mean, that doesn't prove that he didn't have, you know, because there's, people can have, you know, you have people that are very important to you and you love, doesn't mean you don't have any gripes. You can still have gripes. And if there is separation and a reunion, you could have a tremendous scene of crying and all that. That doesn't mean that your gripes go, that's the way we are. I mean, I guess you can love a person and have gripes against them. In fact, precisely those are the ones who usually have the gripes. Because you have the special relationship, so you expect more. But I don't get the sense, not that it matters whether I get the sense or not, I'm just expressing myself, I don't get the sense that Yosef had these gripes against his father. And if he did, then why didn't he ask his father respectfully? Not, you know, not that I suspect you of anything wrong and all this, but, you know, it always troubled me all these years that my mother was not buried in Ha'aretz HaMachpelah. And certainly when the time came and he took the shvuah, then Yosef had a right to ask his father for an explanation. Now, do you think that Yosef suspected his father? That is to say, he knew that she wasn't buried there. I imagine he knew the circumstances of her death. Now, for me, it's hard to imagine that Yosef would have thought that Yaakov failed to bury her there for selfish reasons, for anything short of absolute necessity. Whether he knew about that Dibur or whether he didn't know about the Dibur, that's something else. But I have a bit of a problem with that. Does anyone of the Mefarshim we've read, I think the one that helps us the most would be Rashi. And why do I say that? The Evan Ezra says that he told it to Yosef, that he shouldn't be angry, that he's asking him to do something that he didn't do for the honor of his mother. My question with that is that, first of all, if that's the case, then why didn't he say this before he made the request? And B, where did he have any indication that Yosef, what was the truth? Was Yosef actually, is that true that Yosef actually was upset and this was necessary? We don't know. Now, if we don't know, I think Esty's question is legitimate. So what are we learning from this? Well, that's always the case. We have to walk away at the best of our ability, to make sense out of a pasuk, and then to be, what have we learned? What's it teaching us? We're not always able to do that. We don't have any guarantee that we can figure out every pasuk and or what its lesson is. But we try. See, Rashi is learning that the reason he's telling him this is because he's placing this burden upon Yosef, and I didn't do the same for your mother. He doesn't mention that. No, he does mention. He says, "V'yadati sheyesh b'lib chalai." That's a very strong statement. The Evan Ezra doesn't say that. And he says, I know that you have in your heart, it bothers you. And how did he know? But at least Rashi helps us to explain what the Torah is communicating to us. I mean, like, ask these questions. Because he's not... See, he's different than... the other Mefarshim. The other Mefarshim, like the Evan Ezra, and even the Sfarno, are saying that it was too difficult. You have to understand the situation. It was too difficult. We can understand that, because he's got a, it happens suddenly, and he's overcome by emotion. I mean, this was the wife that he really loved. I mean, we know that. This was the wife that he really chose. All right, he stayed married to Leah, but even she realized that she wasn't the loved one. And she was young, and he didn't have the, so he had young children. He had young children, and he had a whole big group there. We don't know the practical circumstances, whether he could have arranged for members of his entourage. To stay behind and watch, you know, the animals, watch the children, etc. And he would go off by himself. Not by himself. I mean, he could have taken some people. He had a camp. He could have taken some people. But I'm not saying that I'm challenging what he's saying, which would be absurd. We don't know the particularities and why it was too much of a burden. We don't know, and we believe every word he says. That's not a problem for us. But that's what they're learning. They're learning that he's communicating to him that I just couldn't do it. And when somebody tells you that, I mean, a lot of times people need excuses. They don't want to do certain things. I mean, you know that when you ask for certain favors, and I can't, I'm just too swamped right now. I'm too busy, right? I just can't do that, and so on. And we all do the same thing ourselves, and we don't want to do something. I mean, sometimes it's absolutely impossible. Sometimes we really don't want to do it, so we're swamped. Okay, fine. But with certain people, with somebody like Yaakov Avinu, and something as significant as burying Rachel in the Meiros HaMachpelah, so then you'd think he would do it. Especially since he's asking Yosef, whose tircha is much, much greater, there's no comparison, as we discussed yesterday, that it was not a simple thing to do just to get permission. So, but if that's what Yaakov says, so we accept it. Because we know how much he would want to do that to show honor to Rachel, and he would do it. So if he's telling us that it just couldn't, certain things are impossible. So then we believe him. Now, as far as Rashi is concerned, that's not the factor. Rashi does not say that's the reason. I don't think I missed that in Rashi. Rashi is saying that he did it al pi hadibur. That is, that there's a reason, and this is nevuah, that Hashem told me that this is very, she's going to play, it's very, very essential, it's very, very important. Because in the future, the Jews are going to be exiled, and the fact that she's buried over there, all right, however, we don't interpret literally that she comes out and cries. I think basically it means that it's as though that the when the Jews are going into exile, they'll remember Rachel Imenu and all the travails that she went through. And that will give them the ability to withstand the travails that, that they're going to be subjected to. That's one level of a reasonable interpretation. That's not our challenge right now. So then he's communicating to Yosef that it didn't have anything to do with me. It wasn't because I couldn't do it. But rather, I was acting al pi hadibur, and it's also to the contrary. See, I wanted to say that, in a sense, what he's telling Yosef is that don't be upset that your mother wasn't buried in the Maaris HaMachpelah, because in point of fact, she was, according to this interpretation. How so? The purpose of the Maaris HaMachpelah was for all the future generations should associate our ownership of the land with the Avos, that we are the descendants of the Avos. And that's the most significant place. In fact, I say that today the Maaris HaMachpelah is of greater holiness or significance than the Kotel, even though it's not treated that, it's not looked on that way. People go there, but people go there for the wrong reasons. They go because they go to the graves of Tzaddikim, and not for the right reasons. It really becomes a mystical, magical thing, a special place, and it is a borderline problem if they think they're praying to the dead or things of that sort. Whereas the purpose of going, there is a very, very significant purpose of visiting the Maaris HaMachpelah, and that's to call to mind the existence of the Avos and their lives and what they did and so on and so forth, and the Imahos as well. That's the real purpose of the Maaris HaMachpelah. And that's available today. Whereas in terms of the Kotel, I don't know what the significance of going to the Kotel. I'm not saying it's not significant, I guess, because you remember, that we used to have the Migdash and things of that sort. But right now we don't have the Beis HaMikdash. And ironically, the place which is designated as a very, very, significant place for Tefillah, which would be the Har HaBayis. So we don't have that either. The Har HaBayis is a very controversial matter as to whether you can go there or not. You have to know the exact places. But there are places where you can go. You're very careful, but there are places where you can go. But it's become a very, very, hot issue because, ironically, even though it's under the control, it depends how you mean control, it's under the control of Israel. Israel captured it in the Six-Day War, but for whatever reason, Dayan decided to give it back to the Jordanian authority. It's called the WAC or something like that. It's spelled W-A-Q-F. I assume he thought that the gesture would be appreciated. Of course, it wasn't. And they set up all kinds of rules restricting when Jews could go there. But they made an absolute that Jews are not permitted to pray there. So they have monitors. Anytime Jews go there, if they spot you saying a prayer, anything that could be construed as a prayer, so then they get an Israeli policeman to haul you off. Because it's a violation of Israeli law, ironically enough. Anyways, what I mean by that is that if that was the purpose of the Maaris HaMachpelah, that the lives of the Avos should be real, should never be forgotten, and there's a place which is designated for people to remember that, and to identify, you see that Kalev went to Hebron and he prostrated himself on the grave of the Avos. And if that's the case, so then the way I look at it, see Rachel, she's part of that group, but she was the the matriarch, so to speak, for the she was the most suited of all because of her life. There was a very tragic element in her life, so she was the most suited that she should be the matriarch for when the Jews are going into exile. So she was deliberately buried in a place where she'd be the, you know, when they were going into exile, they'd pass by her grave and call to mind her life, and that would inspire them. So in that sense, she was buried, but her burial spot, in order to fulfill the purpose of those who were buried in the Maris HaMachpelah, was for the exiles. We can understand in terms of ask these questions, so that's what the Torah is teaching us here. That is that that there was a purpose. It wasn't just an inability. Like, that's an excuse. See, the way the Eben Ezra learns it, and the way Sforno seems to be learning it, is that it's an excuse. I just couldn't. But Rashi is not learning it that way. Rashi is learning, apparently, that he could have, he would have, and so forth. But there's a very, very significant reason for this, and it's not lacking in kavod for your mother. Because, like I say, in the truest sense, there was her burial was the same burial as the, and done in the same manner and for the same purpose as all the avos and imos, except she had a specific role to play for the future when the Jews would go into exile. Go on, I assume we'll do tomorrow, or next time, that'll be next week, the critique of the Ramban. And also, we'll try to make some sense out of the Sforno. I never saw the Sforno before. And I haven't checked. Rabbi Pelkowitz usually has very, very good footnotes. It's another advantage in explaining difficult Sfornos. So we'll put that aside for the time being. But maybe this is the time to deal with the question as to that I asked before, and I think Esther agreed, that we don't get any sense that Yosef had any type of bitterness or complaints. Yosef never asked. And at this point in time, when he was being asked to do this, would have been an opportune moment to ask very respectfully, okay, if it's that important, so how come my mother is not buried there? That would not have been disrespectful. I think kibud av v'aim does not prohibit a person from asking a question of that sort as long as it's done respectfully. And you could do it respectfully, and you could even say, you may not want to discuss this, and if so, I'm fine with that. But if it's okay, and you have no problem discussing it, could you please explain to me? So I think that's something to remember, because a lot of times we have questions of our parents and so forth, or even rabbis, whatever it may be, and you feel that maybe it's not respectful even to ask. But there's a way to deal with that. Because you can ask for permission to ask. And if you're given permission, you could state the question in a respectful way. So, does anybody want to offer some kind of a suggestion? I think in dealing with this, I mean, my questions, that there's no indication that Yosef was bothered by this, and if he was, he could have asked, and he never did ask. And so on and so forth. I think that to make sense out of this, and when Yaakov says, according to Rashi, that I know that you have in your heart grievances against me, we clearly have to differentiate between the conscious level. I don't know if it's unconscious. Not everything is unconscious. I don't mean unconscious. When we use the term unconscious, I mean, classically, it means things that you just have no awareness of. That there are things buried in your unconscious. They've been repressed. And you're not even aware of them. The word for what we're talking about, I would not say unconscious. I would say suppressed. There are things that you have suppressed. So this happens in virtually every relationship. It doesn't make any difference who we're talking about, because that even in the most, you know, positive or loving relationships, there's ambivalence, there's negativity. Except even in a great marriage or whatever, relationship, great friends, there's things that bother you. There are things that bother you that the other person did. And you don't always, sometimes you don't bring them up for whatever reason. And you just get past them and you go on. Now, in that case, I wouldn't say that it's repressed and you no longer have any awareness, but you suppress them. You just don't think about them. And it's possible that eventually you'll even forget them, but that's not necessarily so. They've been suppressed. And they don't have any effect. They're not operational, so to speak. So now you see, because it's going to interfere. Now when you see the person, you don't think about it anymore. You've gotten over it, and then you have fun together and this and that, as though it never happened. But it's there. I think it's more in that sense. That Yosef never questioned his father. He never questioned his father. He never made an issue out of this. That is, he never asked, why didn't you bury my mother in the Maariv HaMakpel? Never asked that question. Why didn't he ask that question? Because he recognized that his father was a great tzaddik and that he did the right thing. And Yaakov never explained it to him either. We could ask that question when he was younger. Yaakov didn't, he could have explained it to him. When he was old enough to know, he must have told, I don't know how old Yosef was at the time. There was enough time. Yosef was not sold until he was 17, so there were a number of years. And Yosef was clearly, he was the most advanced intellectually, clearly. It's something that the Yaakov could have told him. But Yaakov didn't tell him. And you wonder why. Why does it have to wait until now? So I would say, and I'm just guessing on this, that Yaakov didn't tell him. Because you don't have to tell. Part of a person's training is that he has to be able to accept. He has to respect and accept the actions of a tremendous tzaddik, or chacham. Chacham, tzaddik. It shouldn't be necessary that a parent or a Rebbe, and I'm talking about righteous people, have to explain everything to you. Why? Why is that? Why you shouldn't be suspicious of other people? You're not allowed to be choshed. You're not allowed to be suspicious that the person did something wrong. So I would say that there was no necessity. Yaakov and Yosef, when they were together, they studied the abstract matters and so forth. It's not necessary for me to explain. And Yosef didn't ask because he didn't know the reason, but he assumed that if his father did it, there must have been a good reason. So I would say that he accepted it, but that would be in the category of things that you suppress. Because that doesn't mean that it didn't bother him. That does not mean that it didn't bother him. Because the fact that his mother is not buried there, that might bother him. Doesn't mean I blame you, but it might bother me. So it's interesting. We cannot say that Yaakov communicated this to him now because he was proof that this is the case. That Yaakov did not think that it was necessary to explain. And Yosef did not demand an explanation. Because Yosef agreed to the request of his father that that he should bury him there. Before the explanation. So the explanation was not intended to secure the that Yosef's agreement. He had the same thing, it would have been the same outcome. Had he not explained this to him, it would have been the same outcome. He took a shvuah, he went to Paro, and he did what he had to do. He buried him in the Maaret HaMachpelah. So clearly that was not the reason. But I agree that he wanted Yosef, because he knew that is something that would bother him. He would think about it. And it would bother him. Why wasn't she buried? It's different. It's one thing to hold it against you. I don't hold it against you. Rashi is using that terminology. But still, it bothers you. It's still on your mind. And I agree that now is the time, because he's going to die. He's going to die. And he has to, if he's ever going to tell it to him, it has to be now. And now the subject matter comes to mind, because he's a human being, and it can't help, but not to associate. Okay, so it didn't come up all these years. It did not enter into my calculations. But now that you're dying, and now that you're pointing out how important this Maaret HaMachpelah, that's the whole, it's so important to be buried in the Maaret HaMachpelah that you got to take a shvuah, and so forth. So if that's the case, it's clearly going to re-arouse that issue. And I think that's why he says now he says it's belibcha. After the request, after the shvuah, now that you've made the shvuah, in which I have confirmed for you the tremendous significance of that, so it's got to be a problem for you. And I don't want it to be a problem for you. So there's two answers we have. That is, now I'm going to explain it to you so that you don't have to go on ever wondering about this anymore. It shouldn't take up any energy, or it should not be a source of pain or a question on your mind, even though I know that you'll accept it because I'm the father and all of that. But still, I want it to be removed so that you'll have complete peace of mind with regard to this matter. And there's two answers that we have so far. Well, what is the difference between the Ibn Ezra, say, and Rashi? Ibn Ezra and Sforno. With regard to this matter, the Ibn Ezra lines up with the Sforno, as opposed to Rashi. See, the Ibn Ezra and the Sforno are basically saying, their answer can be summed up in one word. What's the one word? It was impossible. I couldn't do it. Whether it's because of the grief that I was in, or because of the situation that I had the whole family to take care of, and so on and so forth. So it wasn't possible. But this situation that I'm asking you to do is possible. That's one answer. I think that Rashi has a better answer. Because, okay, maybe it wasn't possible. But then you're simply saying that it would have been a good thing to do it, but I couldn't. Okay. But a better answer would be that she did have the full kavod. That it wasn't impossible, and I would have done it, but I'll pi hadibur. That she has a role to play in terms of the future of Klal Yisrael. Ah, that's a satisfying thing. That's a positive. There's two kinds of answers that you give when people are concerned that you didn't do something which they think you should have done. And okay, one is you prove to them that you're not liable. I'm not liable. And then you got to bring out all of the reasons why you're not liable. That's generally speaking, okay, maybe begrudgingly they'll accept the fact. But a much better approach, if you can, is to say, you have to appreciate what I did do. That what I did do and how I handle it is much, much more effective and meaningful and productive. If you convince them of that, then they feel happy. Because there's a positive takeaway. Now, I'm not saying that that's what the issue is over here. But those are the two approaches as to Yaakov's justification. Okay, so we'll stop here. We have to do the Ramban, and we have to figure out that Sforno. The Sforno takes a completely different approach. I'm sorry? The Sforno, excuse me, the Sforno, just for starters, the Sforno does not seem to be following, as far as this line is concerned. That is, that Yaakov's purpose, it doesn't seem from what he's saying, that Yaakov's purpose is to remove any grievance that Yosef might have. But we'll see. Okay, good.
For the purpose of their relationship, like which way are you saying? Like the purpose of their relationship or the purpose of Yosef being able?
No, what I'm saying, excuse me, what I'm saying, I think I understand your question. I'm saying that this was not done for a functional. That is to say that it would make it, more likely that Yosef would carry out the task. Because he told him this after he had already agreed. And I think he trusted Yosef completely, that he would keep his word, certainly a shvuah. But I think it was done...
So like out of kindness to Yosef.
I'm sorry?
Like out of kindness to Yosef?
Of course, yeah. Out of kindness to Yosef, that he should now have... Now is the time. There was a time when it wasn't necessary to explain because the child has to learn to trust his father. And he doesn't have to explain everything. That's a very important teaching. But that's past now. There's no... Yosef passed that test. Now, he wants to leave him with a good, positive attitude towards this whole thing. That it shouldn't be like a question mark in his mind. It'll always be a question mark, and it'll always be something that bothers him. Of course, he'll say, look, I can't blame my father. He must have had a good reason, but it'll always be a question mark. So he didn't want to leave him in that state. That's my opinion. We're dealing with a practical question. There are times... with regard to students or children or whatever, even friends, that there should not be any need to explain. And that when they challenge you on certain things, and, you know, you have a right to say, well, I have your best interest, you don't trust me, and so on and so forth. And so, as I said, that's something that's a good thing to develop. However, The other side of the coin is that where a person is carrying something around that's going to bother him, and you can give them an explanation and remove that burden from their mind. So in general, my answer would be, yeah, you should. I don't know all the particulars, though. We'd have to know what the particulars, because sometimes when you tell them this, it might cause him to look badly at somebody else. I mean, yeah, you have to. I'm only talking in general terms. But if you have a relationship with someone and so on and so forth, and there's something that's troubling them about something you may have done or whatever the case may be, and it's the kind of thing which, you know, you've said, look, either you trust me or you don't trust me. I'm not going to explain.
Rabbi?
Yes.
I mean, could that, those two things together be why the explanation came when it seemed to be not necessary? After he had already said, yes, I'll do this, and he agreed. And in other words, he was giving him comfort, but it shouldn't have been necessary for him to have the explanation in order to agree to this request of his father.
Yeah, that's a good point, and I kind of was touching on that. Maybe I didn't say that as explicitly. But I agree. He didn't, but I did make the point that he did not tell him this in order to facilitate that Yosef would do it. I said it a few minutes ago. Because he knew that Yosef would do it. Yosef would do it. It wasn't to facilitate that. It wasn't practical. And you're right, there's an extra benefit that Yosef gets more schar, so to speak, because Yosef is doing it, even though it's bringing up this issue, and you're asking me to do something which you didn't do for my mother, and so on and so forth. The fact that Yosef would still do it is a greater mitzvah for him. So I agree. That's another reason why he didn't ask before. But now that Yosef agreed, and there was no practical reason, so now he wanted to give him that benefit, the Yishuv Hadas factor, the to ease peace of mind He shouldn't be troubled. So that if these thoughts would ever arise, well, they wouldn't arise once he has satisfaction. Now, of course, according to Rashi, as I said, it's even better, because it's not just explaining away why I couldn't do it. All right? That, if that's the only answer, that's the only answer. Okay? And he would accept it. But it's not as good as the answer if you could say that I did it al pi hadibur. Yeah, he wanted, he did not want Yosef to ever be troubled by that. Not that it would affect his behavior and so on and so forth, because he didn't act that way. But still, in terms of the psyche and putting a lot of these things to bed, so to speak. I mean, there's a lot of things that everybody has in their life that bothers them, that things happen and they never got a satisfactory explanation. And so they go on and all of that, and it comes up from time to time, and it bothers them. So if you can supply an explanation that will remove that troubling element from their minds, yeah, that's a good thing. All right, it's Monday, January 8th, 2018, Masoret. All right, so we're continuing with the theme that we left off with last week, which was the arrangements that Yaakov made prior to his death pertaining to a few things, a few matters. One of them was the oath that he requested of Yosef that he would not bury him in Mitzrayim and that he would bury him in the Aras HaMachpelah. In the course of those psukim, there appears, to me, it seems like a strange pasuk coming out of nowhere. And obviously we take every pasuk seriously. That is, there's nothing, I always operate with the principle, there's nothing superfluous in the Torah, as there is in ordinary compositions, in our conversations, in teaching, in writing. You can't say every word teaches a profound idea. We communicate, hopefully, in general, we're getting across some serious ideas, but you can't expect every sentence. There's some repetition. There's some things that really weren't that necessary, but the writer put it in or whatever. But in the Torah, since it comes from Hashem, every word is necessary and contains some teaching. So, in the middle of the story of Yaakov's blessings, not the blessings to the 12 tribes, but essentially the arrangement that the two sons of Yosef, each one would have the status of a tribe. So then it says in that chapter 48, verse 7, Vani b'voy mipadon mesolai Rachel, when I was returning from Padan, literally, Rachel died on me in the land of Canaan on the road when there was just a small amount of space to get to Ephrat. And I buried her there on the road to Ephrat, which is Beis Lechem. So we've been struggling with that pasuk. What's the idea? What was the idea over here? Why is he mentioning the fact that Rachel died on the road and he buried her there on the road to Ephrat, which is Beis Lechem? So there were two different approaches. Essentially, Rashi and the Ibn Ezra seem to be taking the same approach. And that is, it comes only because of the fact that he's made this enormous request of Yosef. We were discussing last week that it was no small matter to do something. This is a big undertaking and could potentially affect their relationship with Paro in Egypt. You have to think about all these things. There's consequences. And Yaakov was cognizant of that. Yosef did have the power, the position to be able to do it, but it's something you got to think about. Do you want to do a thing like that, which could, on some level, offend the Egyptians? Because I mentioned in the case of Rothschild, and which the Rav brings down, and de Gaulle wanted him to be buried in France, and so on. So this was a huge request to do. I mean, you had to arrange. It was a whole, you can imagine what that looked like. There was a whole procession, because all of the illustrious men of Egypt accompanied him. And even today, even driving through the from Egypt, which you can do, through the desert from Egypt to Israel, you know, it's a trip. How much more so in those days? So they both say, therefore, Yaakov felt that he had to remove any type of resentments that Yosef might harbor. Because look at the contrast. Look at what he's asking me to do to bury him in the Ma'aretz HaMakpelah, which only shows you how significant that is. That means that it's so important to him. And if that's the case, then why did he not see fit to bury my mother there? And Yaakov saw fit to resolve any residual resentments that he might hold. And so he explained to him that, I mean, according to the Eben Ezra, according to the Plame Pshat, so they split off on that. In other words, so why didn't you? If it's that important, so why didn't he bury her there? So the Eben Ezra is learning, because it was the circumstances at the time that he was burdened. So that's what the Eben Ezra says. Shemesa pitom. She died suddenly. V'lo yecholti lo licha l'kavra b'ma'ara kasher kavarti leah. It was the circumstances. She died suddenly, and I didn't have the ability to bring her to the Ma'ara, as I did when Leah died. And he said this to Yosef, that he shouldn't be upset, that I'm asking you for something which I didn't do for the honor of your mother. Just, we'll leave it at this stage tangentially. So Esther asked, okay, so fine, so that, but why is the Torah telling this to us? That's a good question. Our first task generally is to try and figure out what's the pshat, what's being said. But after that's done, it's definitely legitimate to ask, so why do I need to know this? What's the bigger teaching? And that's the kind of thing that generally is so beneficial about the Ralbag. We have made great use of the Ralbag over the years. Because the Ralbag, and I recommend it, his Hebrew is a little bit tough, though. You got to get used to it. That would be great if they translated it into English. He has what's called the Toalitot. At the end of virtually, he goes through the major psukim, and he essentially explains, gives you the pshat, which is very good. Then at the end, he gives you what he calls the Toalitot, the benefits. See, Pixar, I mean, you get really very nice, a lot of them are practical, simple, like, what's the benefit of this teaching? What's the benefit of that? And he kind of, you know, he has a lot of good ideas. And that's what he's trying to do, to show you that the essentially giving you the reason why the Torah brings this down altogether. So that's his type of question. And I'm putting the question on the side for the time being, because I want to go through the various pshatim. That itself hopefully will help us to understand what the point is, what the benefit is. And then we'll try and explain, you know, give a reason if we can, for why the Torah is telling us this, and we'll consult with the Ralbag as well. Okay, so just remind me, because I want to proceed today and get through these four now, so at least we have all the pshatim, and we'll leave that to the end. According to the way the Eben Ezra explains them, I'm just giving my take. I have a right to give my take on things, as to whether that this pshat or that pshat. I mean, remember, we're not obligated to accept any of these pshatim. We had that lengthy discussion, because this is not part of the Masorah. So you have Rashi, you have the Eben Ezra. These are great, great sages, but they were essentially giving their own understanding of what's going on. So we have a right to study it. And I never say that I think he's wrong, or I just say I don't really get it, or I don't see it because of such and such a reason. Now, according to the Evan Ezra, I think it's a little, to me, it's just not that convincing. And Rashi too. This is, we explained why he met Yaakov, mentioned this after Yosef had already agreed. So I would say that no, there was no hesitation. I don't think he sensed any hesitation in Yosef. There was absolutely no indication that this was bothering Yosef. So it's like, Shelo Yichal, you shouldn't be upset. Okay, you could say, though, you can say that I'll try to answer my own question on the Evan Ezra and on Rashi. Because Rashi gives a different answer, but they're both based on the same premise. That Rashi says it more directly. I know that in your heart you have certain concerns or issues with me. But this would, the way the Evan Ezra learns, this would explain why he's doing this now. And even after he's asked. And even after Yosef has agreed. But I think, and this might be the, there might lie in what I'm going to say right now, the answer to Esty's question as to why the Torah is telling us this. So I'll tell you what I think on the Evan Ezra. Of course, we know that everybody's human. So all of our questions about the fact that Yosef never complained and Yosef didn't bring it up now and so on and so forth. But still, we're dealing with human beings. And Yaakov was concerned. Because it's one thing to agree. Lots of times, I'm sure we've all been there, lots of times people ask you to do certain things for them, certain favors. And at the time they ask, you know, it doesn't seem to be, or you feel I ought to do such a thing. A lot of times you feel I ought to do. We're never there. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but we're never really sure. Do I really have to do that? And sometimes we feel guilty if we don't do that. You know, sometimes it's clear to us that we should do it because we really have an obligation to this person and the thing they're asking is not such a big deal. And, you know, there's all different kinds of things people ask you to do. Then there are things that could be more complicated. You know, it's like a friend is making a kiddush for their son's graduation, bar mitzvah, whatever it is, and they know that you're going to be in Brooklyn, and they have an order in a store there, and you're going in that area, and they ask you to pick something up. So that's, of course, anything can get messed up. but you figure, what's the big deal? How can I say no? All right, so you know, you may go out of your way a few blocks and whatever, and find the parking, but you know. You kind of feel that I should do this. But there's any variety of requests that people have. But there's also a gap, because sometimes at the time they asked and the mood we were in and so on, you may have just come back from a shiur about helping people. it put you, those bad times, put you in a certain mood, and then you got a phone call about that very thing, and now you're in the mood, but you really want to fulfill it. But there's a difference that when it comes time to actually do it, you may not be in the same mood anymore. That is to say, I think we've all been through the experience that we agreed to do things and then afterwards wondered, why the heck, that's an acceptable word, why the heck did I agree to do that? And then you sort of think back, you know, I was too guilty, I felt too guilty, and so on and so forth. I got to be more careful next time. But I think that what I'm saying is part of everybody's reality. There are people that may take advantage. That's also, I think we learn a very important lesson from this. And that is v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. This seemed like a seemingly, you know, not such a serious issue in life. But I do believe that there is a teaching over here already. In other words, part of my answer to Esty's question will be that there's a lesson in V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. You may not see where I'm going yet, but it hopefully will become clear. And that is that one, since we've been on the receiving end, okay, where we have been asked to do things which we subsequently regretted for various reasons. And it's not necessarily, look, these things happen. It's not necessarily anybody's fault. And it's not necessary if you agreed to do it because at the time it didn't seem like such a big deal. And especially the way it was being presented. But anything can become a big deal nowadays. Like bringing something to Israel or even, you know, if you're going to a different state. Just the mere fact that there's such restrictions with traveling and security. And you could, you know, they could have stopped you. Let's say, for argument's sake, you had it on your carry-on. And you have no idea that there's an issue, but there could be an issue. It could be a device that they're concerned about. So they could have stopped you and this and that. It could have wound up being a half hour, 45-minute delay, which is annoying. You know, it's annoying enough to have to put up with the normal on a good day, so to speak, when you have to go through the security. So now you're thinking, you know, here I am doing a favor, and because of this favor, I have this problem. Well, then they may say, no, this you can't take on the plane. Oh, that's really fun. So now what am I going to do? Oh, so then you're going to have to check. You're going to have to check it. So that becomes a whole new hassle because you've already checked your luggage. And you're, you know, so then you're going to have to go back, you know, to a different counter, and they're going to have to put it in a box and seal it, and you're going to have to pay for it. And so something which seemed to be innocent because you're a good person and, you know, a good nature. So you know, you're paying a price. Look, it's not the end of the world, but it's annoying. And then you don't want to charge the person. It becomes a problem, too. When you tell the person, you know, that you had to pay extra for it. So, whatever. The thing is like this, then, that I think that in general, there's no psak halach over here. When people ask you to do favors, you got to, like anything else, you got to be kind, compassionate, but intelligent. You don't have to feel that, you know, you're obligated. You're not obligated to do each and everything. You have to look at it carefully, think it over. You know, if you're going on a vacation and so on and so forth, if it's a big, generally, there's, even psychologically, if it's a business trip, you have a different mentality. So you're more willing to do, you know, things, favors. But, if it's a vacation, you're in a certain vacation mode and you want to have fun. Even when you're going to the airport and getting on the plane, you don't want to be bogged down. You have a right to consider all these things. Then you have to consider who it is and what they've done for you. So if this person has done you those kinds of favors, then there's hakaras hatov. I mean, then you got to be careful about that. Because that's another thing we've all experienced, where we've gone out of our way for somebody else and done major league favors. And then when we, you know, a certain amount of time goes by and we need something, and you don't find the same attitude in them. So, you know, you have to factor in a lot of things, but I think the best thing that we can do is don't harden your heart. I'm not saying that you should stop being nice and stop being compassionate. I don't, that would definitely not be good. But it shouldn't be just that emotional reaction of guilt, or, you know, you're afraid that this person's not going to like you, and so on and so forth. And you have a right to think it over. So in those cases, all I would say is that it's best not to answer on the spot, because that's when you're overcome by the emotion. It's best to say, you know, let me think about that, because I'll get back to you on that. And then you could think it over carefully, and then if you're going to do it, you're going to do it, and if not, you can explain in a good way why you can't do it. That's the only advice I can give. Now, I would say the v'ahavtarech kamocha, there's another component to this, and that is that the thing that we're complaining about when others do it to us, but I'm sure we do the same thing too. that we have favors we want people to do for us. And, you know, I guess we have our calculations. If I ask somebody for a favor, I have a whole calculation. There's what I've done for this person in the past and then how I've helped this person. And what I'm asking for, though, is it reasonable, not reasonable? Is it too difficult? And so on and so forth. And that's not always accurate, necessarily. Nobody's perfect with these things. But v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, because you may be in a position where, because of the relationship and the influence and so forth, you may, not overtly, but indirectly, be coercing the other person. Because you're putting the person on the spot and they really can't say no. There are people, there are situations that you just can't say no. And I'm sure you tell that over. You know, so-and-so asked me, you know, to do this and that, but how could I say no to him? How can I say no to her? I just can't say no. But you don't really want to do it. You don't really want to do it, but I can't say no. How can I say no? So that's part of the price you pay in life. That's there. But I would say that the issue of the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha does come in. And that is that just like, that's the Ahavta L'Reicha Kamocha, just like you don't want to be that which is distasteful to you. When people do that to you and they put you in a position which you don't really want to be in, but you sort of can't get out of it, so you don't like that. You don't want it to be done. I wish he wouldn't have asked me. You just wish you hadn't answered that phone call. You know, it's kind of like you're on your, just about to leave the house to go to the airport for your trip, and the phone rang, and you answered it, and that's when the request came in for this last minute thing to schlep along with you. And you couldn't say no. So then you're like, why did I answer the phone? Now, v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha, in my opinion, would express itself the next time you're in the position where you're going to make the request from somebody else. Put yourself in his position. What the effect is going to be. The mere fact that you can get the person to agree to do it doesn't mean it's right. Or even the mere fact that you did something for that, you have to, these things are very hard to calibrate. There are things which are legitimate. Every it goes by the relationship. There's so many different relationships that you have. I mean, there are people that owe you. This person owes me. I've done huge things for them. You know, like when they had this thing, this crisis, I took their kids in for a few days and took care of them. You know, like that's major league stuff. And now what I'm asking doesn't even compare to that. This person owes me. I have a right to ask. So I'm not saying that that's not part of the case. Just be prepared that they may have forgotten, or they may say no. They may not have the hakaras atov that you sort of take for granted. But all I'm saying is, though, that you should employ v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. That is, just because a person's going somewhere and you need that favor, should not be, that doesn't mean that you should ask. And the fact is, well, they could have said no. I don't accept that. The fact of the matter is that if they didn't want to do it, they would have said no. That's true of some people, but there's a lot of people that don't have that kind of a constitution, and they will say yes, even though really they would prefer to say no. So that's, then you don't do it. V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Don't ask the other person to do the kind of things that you wouldn't want people to ask you. Now, in a sense, it's a shame, because a lot of times you do a tov and you don't feel good about it. You don't feel good about it. It's not every tov that you do. Generally speaking, you do a tov, you should feel good. But a lot of times you don't feel good about it because you feel you were taken advantage of, you were used, and or it wasn't really appreciated. So then that's sort of like a diminishing of your worth. Your dignity. They sort of just used you. So I'm saying we really have to incorporate that. And remind me to, I just want to say, there's an interesting pshat that I have in this week's parsha. Some of you may have heard it before, not the first time I said it, which I think will back me up. So remind me about the interaction between Moshe and the daughters of Yisroel. Now, if that's the case, then the Eben Ezra does make a lot of sense. Because nobody is saying that Yosef harbored, Rashi's saying that. But let's take the Eben Ezra. He's not saying that. He's saying that it should not. You shouldn't be upset that I'm asking you to do what I didn't do for the covet of your mother. That is to say, it doesn't mean that Yosef came into that discussion with that feeling. He may not have been thinking about it, as we've said. He may have been at total peace with it because he trusted his father and so on and so forth. And had not this request come along, then Yosef never would have thought about it, would have never been upset about it. However, Yaakov anticipated that now that I'm asking you to do this, and you're going to have to go through this whole ordeal, which it is. I mean, if we just consider going to Israel today with all the with the airplane, this and that, still we consider it an ordeal to get to the airport on time, the traffic, the bags, the checking, the lines, security, you know, even seating and making sure that you have room in the overhead. Everything becomes a pain, at least for me. I mean, I hardly travel anymore, minimal. And if it's within, I'd rather drive. Because I don't, except for the traffic factor, but depending, you know, like we used to go to, when I was in New York, we used to go to Chicago, generally Thanksgiving, July 4th. So it was about a 13-hour drive. That was fine. I didn't have to worry, you know, I had enough room in the car for my stuff. Didn't have to pack just exactly this bag or that bag. And we could leave whatever time we wanted and so on and so forth. Even Florida, well, a number of trips. We went to Florida, we drove, and it was less stressful for me. I find it relaxing, actually, than going to the by my plane. So, if that is an ordeal today, can you imagine what the ordeal had to be then? A huge ordeal. The Torah doesn't go into that. It's not going into the particulars. First, he had to get the permission. And then the organization, you know what this entails, and all the people that are going to be going, and the wagons, and the provisions, and then the act, you know, the problems of the road, whatever it entails. This is a major league operation, and it's all on the shoulders of Yosef. We don't think about that, you know, look back, it's, you know, Yosef, it's all magic, no problem, everything goes smoothly. Because the Torah doesn't go into those things. But as a result of this Eben Ezra, so he's a human being, Yosef, and like, oh my God, this is what I'm going through, which I don't mind doing, but, you know, why? He didn't do this, and this is his father Yaakov, but he didn't do this for my mother. Now look at the difference. Start making the comparison. How far was he from the Maris HaMachpelah? It wasn't that far. And he didn't have the whole problem with getting permission from a king and so on and so forth. But he didn't do it. So apparently, either it wasn't all that important, or maybe he didn't think my mother's being there was the most important thing. These feelings could definitely be aroused. After. That's why we're talking about the difference, the gap between when you agree to do something Because at the time, I mean, a lot of times like that, we agree to do things, especially if they're far off, even to go to events we really don't want to go to. But it's like 8 months from now, whatever. So it's not immediate. So you agree. Then as when it actually arrives, like, why did I agree? So clearly, there was the possibility that in the course of doing it, these thoughts would come to his mind. He's just human. See, we can't imagine that the tzaddik, the great tzaddik like Yosef, is not an ordinary human being, that ordinary emotions don't come to the fore. They do. The greatness, of course, of the tzaddik is that how he deals, that he masters his emotions and he acts intelligently and he doesn't just follow his emotions, but he still has the emotions. So Yaakov contemplated that. So that's why the Torah is telling it to us, because it's teaching us the lesson of V'yahavta l'recha kamocha, that you should contemplate. And even when you ask someone to do something for you, and you believe that it's right that he should do it, Yaakov believed that he had a right not just to ask, but to take an oath for all the various reasons. But then you have to contemplate the consequences. And therefore, he had a chiyuv to tell him things, because he could not leave him in a state where this thing would bother him. As a result of doing this, this might arouse emotions that would bother him, and that he has no right to do. So therefore, according to the Ibn Ezra, he had to tell him this. He had to tell him that it was not because the Ma'aras HaMakpelah is not important, and it's not because his mother does not deserve the kavod, but rather it was simply impossible. That's something that Yosef would understand. We have a concept like that in halacha, and that is that anos rachmana patre, that if a person does not do a mitzvah because circumstances make it impossible, that you're living in a place and you ordered a lulav and so on and so forth, and it got messed up because it wasn't packed right or it got lost, and now Sukkot comes and you don't have a lulav and you can't get another one. So what do? Nothing. You're fine. You don't have to do tshuva, because your failure to do the mitzvah of lulav was not because of any neglect on your part. It's an onus. So that's what he's telling him. He's telling him that Yosef would trust his father. Now, Yosef can't prove anything. Yeah, no, there's no facts here. There's no way you can measure it. Well, why couldn't you appoint so-and-so to take care of, why couldn't you do that? And then you could have taken my mother. No. That's not necessary, because he trusts his father. Yaakov was on the highest possible level, and he assessed, that's what he's saying, I assessed the situation. And that's the pasuk, Mesa Alai, Rachel, Be'eretz Kanan, Baderech. And I'm being honest with you, I'm telling you, it wasn't such a long trip, but I buried her on the road, basically. I didn't even bring it to the burial place, because the situation, the circumstances were such at the time that there was nothing else I could do. Now, we all have situations like that. It's hard, by the way. Sometimes you're in a situation like that and you just can't do it. But then you try to explain, let's say, a similar situation, why you didn't do such and such for someone. Okay. They asked you to go visit someone in Israel and whatever. And again, these things seem very easy and very light when you're here in America and you're telling somebody else to do it. But let's say that when you were there, you had a lot of things that you had to do. And new things came up. I don't know. Let's say you were there for a wedding and then turned out that you were needed to do this, this, and that. And you made a calculation and you said, I can't take off the time to make that trip to Haifa to visit some so-and-so's grandmother, whatever you thought you'd be able to do. So now when you come back and you explain, there's no way that you could prove. You don't. This is not provable. And if, you know, somebody, well, why didn't you do it? You know, you could always be broken down. But if somebody knows you, that you're a person of honesty and integrity, and that you're true to your word, so then I'm okay. I trust you. I trust this person. If they say that it was impossible, it was impossible. And I don't hold it against them. So that's
right now,
yes. Go ahead.
Would the same apply to Yosef if he would have been in a situation where it actually, even though he took a shvua, he just really couldn't do it? Would he have been in the same situation?
Yeah. The thing is like this. That's a good question. Had Yosef been unable to carry out the shvua? So what would have been?
Kind of asking him to do something, you know. He condones, if you can't do it, you can't do it. But yet he made him a shvua to do it. Which I understand was practical for Paro. But like, what if he really, you know, what if he had that problem and he couldn't do it?
Well, I mean, you could ask a question, because why take a shvua on something that you don't have control over? That's a good question.
That's a better question.
It's clear that Yosef couldn't guarantee the result. So, well, we could answer that in two ways. We could say that in taking the shvua, he wasn't guaranteeing the result, but he was guaranteeing that he would do everything in his power, that he would undertake that mission and treat it seriously, and because he needed Paro's permission. Without Paro's permission, he couldn't do it. But how could he guarantee that Paro would give permission? So then we could say that either he was not guaranteeing the result, but he was guaranteeing everything that needed to be done, everything in his power. Or you could say that no, he was taking an oath that he would bury him there. However, let's say a person takes an oath and it turns out that he doesn't fulfill it. But the reason he doesn't fulfill it is because it was an honest. So that could happen. Person may have taken an oath that he was going to go again to Israel for the Chag, whatever it is. But then he got really sick and he couldn't go. He had to be in the hospital. So that's not considered breaking an oath. Now, he can, there is a way, as you all know, to be mater neder, to release yourself from vows. You know, that's what everybody does before Rosh Hashanah. In case we took a vow. Because you can take a vow without consciousness. The fact that you sort of mentally agree to do something you don't really have to do. Like astringency, but you take it upon, even though you never formally took it upon yourself, the fact that you do it all the time is considered to be akin to accepting it upon yourself. And then you'd have to be mater neder. That's why I advise people, when you're feeling more from or religious and you're going to, you know, I want to start doing such and such. Or like, you know, I'm going to stand during the repetition of the Shemone Esrei. Things which you don't really have to do. I advise you, when you do that, do it and make a mental stipulation. I am not accepting this upon. I'm just going to do it as I feel, but I'm not accepting it upon myself as a binding custom. So therefore, when the time comes that you find it too difficult to do, you don't have to worry about the fact that you have the nether there. That's what I advise everybody to do. In your moments,
every Yom Kippur.
In your moments of frumkin. They can be very dangerous.
Every Yom Kippur, I think I'm not taking this on.
They're not taking it on.
I have a friend in the yeshiva who did not think that, and she did it for.
No, there are things that I've done, and I've become accustomed to doing. I've become accustomed to doing it, and then there has reached a point where it became I didn't want to do it anymore. for various reasons. But I realized that I had been doing it because I thought, you know, I really thought it was the right thing. And well, I had to be mater neder. I try to remember before I do anything, which was not really required. Actually, this year I had hurt my knee. I don't know if I told you. I had had a bad fall. It was a couple of weeks before the holidays. And I was limping. I was really came down. I don't even know how it happened. I slipped on something. But it was, I really hurt my knee. And I mean, for the first couple of weeks, I was told to just like elevate it and ice packs and stuff like that. And walking to shul was even hard at first because I was limping. And it was starting to heal a little bit. Then on Rosh Hashanah, you know, we do one kriya, one kneeling on Rosh Hashanah. And then on Yom Kippur there, I think four of them. So I got down, and as soon as I put any pressure on my right knee, I just like couldn't support myself. I sort of like fell down on my face. So, you know, it made it worse for the time, temporarily anyways. It was starting to heal. So then I wasn't going to do it on Yom Kippur. It's only 10 days later. So I specified that when I was mater neder, I specified that even though I always do the kriya, I'm not going to do it this year because of the condition of my knee. So as far as Yosef is concerned, it's the, like we just said, the Torah was not given to the ministering angels. And onus rachmana patre. If a person can't do something, simply can't do something, even a shvuah, if he took a shvuah, but he didn't perform it because there's no egregiousness, there's no violation. He was locked in jail for something, who knows, whatever it is. I mean, he couldn't do it. At that point, the person could either be mater neder. But even if for some reason he can't be mater neder, because even that requires a bezdin of three people, etc. So then he's not liable. He's not liable. Look, in general, my advice to people, but you do what you like, is avoid. You know, the Torah says, you know, like, you don't have to. Once you take a vow, you have to keep it. It's very serious. And you don't have to take a vow in the first place. I mentioned this before, that I don't like these charitable, the yeshivos, etc., that call you and they annoy you because they want you to take a pledge. And that's very problematic. First, I mean, they put a lot of pressure on you and you may agree and then you forget about it. And when it comes in, because a lot of junk in the mail and this comes in and you don't remember that and you throw it out. And then you don't even remember who it was that you made the pledge to. So I my position was that that's like lifnei iver. They're placing a stumbling block. Because that is like a vow of charity. It's like a vow. It's a pledge. So I started saying, I'm not going to make any pledges over the phone. I said, if you want to send me an envelope, you could do so. And I'll try. I'll see. Whatever. But I'm not making a pledge. And then, you know, you get into a whole argument with these people. In general, I would avoid. I know people do it, you know, because I think it's good. I know a lot of times people will make a neder to give up smoking. You know, and then you find these very same people having a tough time and they trying to round up a bezdin for people to be mater the neder. Look, it should be used extremely, extremely carefully. Because it is a serious thing. But I would say that Yosef, most probably when he took the vow, serious, he will do everything and anything in his power. But if it's an impossibility, it presupposes that it's a possibility. If it turns out to be an impossibility altogether, then he's not at fault. So the lesson then, according to the reason why the Torah is I'm trying to give something in the style of the Ralbag in terms of the Toelas, the benefit, I would say, that we derive is that Yaakov, you should, if you know that because of the principle of Ahavta L'Recha Kamocha, if you know that you've put a person in a position which is going to arouse resentments, and that's a painful thing for the person, but the person is going to accept it because he's not going to turn his father down. And in the course of doing it, it will bring out painful thoughts that his mother did not get that same honor. Then you have an obligation to relieve that, to explain it to him. Even though it would seem, according to the Eben Ezra, that all things being equal, there was no reason for Yaakov to tell him this. He didn't have to tell him. And Yosef was fine. And but a new factor was coming into play. The factor that he was now being burdened to make all the arrangements to bring Yaakov to the Maaros HaMachpelah, something which he seemingly was much easier for him to do for his mother, but did not do. So yeah, according to the Eben Ezra, he merely said to him, it was impossible. And that's, according to the Eben Ezra, that's all Yosef needed. Yosef did not need anything further. If my father said it was impossible, then it was impossible. And that's the end of that. Statement in the, I think this is a very significant class today, a lesson, whatever, because it's one pasuk. It's not, I owe you something. Hold it a second. Don't let me get away with it. I told you to remind me. The case I wanted to mention about the, you know, asking people for a favor and the fact that you feel kind of abused when you're forced into a situation where you have no choice, you know, and they shouldn't have really even asked you, but I couldn't say no. So you kind of do a good and you don't even feel good about it. So the case where Moshe interferes with the shepherds and drives them off and waters the sheep. So you may have heard this before. So my question always was, okay, he drove them off, but why does he have to water the sheep? And that's their job. And they're quite capable. And they mention later on that an Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds. And he also drew the water and watered the sheep. So my question was, why does, you know, what kind of logic is there to that? A person's in trouble, you save him, you drive off the, you know, the one who's attacking them. You drive off the attacker, okay. Now go about your work. I don't have to do your work for you. So I said that there's two levels when a person suffers an injustice. One is the practical, but then the other one is the psychological. It's a violation. It's like it's an assault on your dignity. It's like, you know, if somebody comes home from the store and they see that they were overcharged, so very often, even they'll go out of their way, they'll drive back to right the wrong, even though it costs them more in gas to go back, because it's like a certain violation of your dignity. So that's what Moshe saw. In other words, it wasn't just the water. That's the practical. So the fact that he drove off, that's not because he didn't do that for them. That's a matter of justice. We can't have this in our society. Okay, if a policeman catches the robber, he's not doing it for you. It's a societal thing. So Moshe saw that there was also a wound was inflicted on their sense of dignity. So then he wanted to restore, he drew the water for them. That was to deal with the personal insult, so to speak. So that's what I'm saying over here. It's like an assault. Like your dignity is not being respected. And your time is not important. You know, you should be subordinate yourself to them. Now, getting back to in the case of justice, justice hopefully restores the loss. But what he was showing is that there's two elements to the loss. And one is personal and psychological in terms of a person's sense of dignity. So generally speaking, in a society, it's hard to address that. You know, they can't.
I would say it was unjust that they were treated in a way that reduce their dignity.
Yeah, that was part of the
respect that they deserve.
Yeah, that was part of the effect. Exactly, that was part of the effect. It wasn't just the practical. So he wanted, he practiced justice on a higher level. And he recognized the personal dimension, and he addressed himself to that as well. So anyways, you know, Chazal say that there's no pasuk in the Torah which doesn't have Tchias HaMesim B'tzida, that is the resurrection of the dead, alongside of it, so to speak. So I think Rav Sheth said, I mean, what do you mean? Every pasuk in the Torah, if you study every pasuk in the Torah, you're going to find a remez, a hint about the resurrection of the dead. So I think he wanted to learn that, you know, it means that something extremely significant. That's like an example. Tchias HaMesim is an example. But the point they're telling you is that there's no pasuk in the Torah which doesn't contain big ideas. So here's a simple pasuk where, you know, you're not expecting anything. And you read the Rashi, okay, it's so that's why he told them, because you shouldn't be upset because I didn't do it. But where's, like, that was a very good question. So where's the teaching? What are we supposed to learn from that? But I think if you go into it, when we did derive a teaching, that it's very, very significant. And it's something which is also very, very practical, because it comes up very, very frequently in our lives. Okay, we'll continue tomorrow. All right, it's Monday, January 15th, 2018, Masoret. We're discussing, I thought it was a very, very interesting and controversial area, the area that we've been discussing, I guess about a week and a half, pertaining to that statement by Yaakov prior to his death. I'm trying to explain, it would seem, it's not even clear, you know, in what context he's presenting the information about his failure to, to bury Rachel in the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. And beyond that, it would appear that he didn't even bring her to the regular cemetery. And rather, he buried her, he just sort of like fashioned some type of a burial place on the road, on the derech to Beis Lechem, Ephrat, which is Beis Lechem. And this seems to be just coming out of nowhere. So it was a very interesting area, and with a lot of insight into the nature of Yosef and the relationship that great people have with their teachers, with their parents, you know, the element of trust that even though Yaakov sensed that Yosef might resent the fact that he had not shown this honor that Yaakov had not shown this honor to his mother, and now he was asking him to make this very, very significant effort. It wasn't an easy thing to get permission from Paro and to make the arduous journey to the Ma'aras HaMachpelah. So he's asking, I mean, we can all relate to these situations. That's what I love about the study of Torah. You know, if you trace down the point, it becomes real and you can really see it operative in your own life. We can all relate to that. I imagine that every one of us has been in a position where we have been asked to do a tremendous favor for someone, and ultimately that was not reciprocated, either in the future when you needed something, which you thought was definitely coming to you given what you had done for that person, and when you asked for it, the other person either didn't quote-unquote remember or didn't view it the same way, did not reciprocate in kind. Or previously, this very same person who's now asking you to do this very significant going out of your way favor when you needed that person had a bunch of excuses why they couldn't do it. So that was very interesting. However, what really was amazing was the approach of the Sephorno, who learns it in a completely different way. And that was something new. I don't think any one of us, I wasn't aware of that interpretation, and that he does not connect it to the request. That in other words, that Yaakov is trying to explain to him for various reasons why he simply could not. It was impossible for him to bury his mother there, and therefore there was no disrespect intended. He didn't want... you know, he was going to die soon. He didn't want Yosef to have to carry this burden around with him for the rest of his life. You know, that bothersome thought without having an answer. And as we said, the Sforno learns completely differently. And for the Sforno, it's a different issue. It has to do with the fact, and I think in terms of context, it fits in better, smoother, according to the Sforno. Because the immediate context is the fact that he has decided and he's declared that the two sons of Yosef, Menashe and Ephraim, shall have the status of individual tribes. And then it's in that context that this statement comes about. And according, it's a very, very fascinating shot. According to the Sforno, he's explaining why he's doing this. And it's because of the prophecy that he got when he came from Paddan. So he's learning it differently. And the prophecy was that nations and community of nations shall come from you. In other words, that God was telling him, God actually did say, pray or vey, that he should be fruitful and multiply. So it was incumbent upon Yaakov to have at least two more children, according to the way, you know, the words stack up. And at that time, at the time of that prophecy, Rachel was pregnant with Binyamin. And we read soon after that that she had a very tough pregnancy and she died. She died giving birth to Binyamin. And according to the Sforno, it's an amazing pshat. What Yaakov is saying is that the reason he didn't bring her to burial, not just in the Maariv HaMachpelah, but even in a regular cemetery, he simply was overwhelmed. Mesa Alai, she died on me. In other words, the Torah is really giving us a tremendous insight into the nature of his relationship in a way that it ordinarily doesn't. I mean, it was just like impossible. It was such a profound loss. He could not organize things to even bring her to a normal cemetery to bury her. And that's the reason for it. But he adds this tantalizing thought. And that is that from that point on, he lost his Yetzirah. He lost his evil inclination. What we mean is he lost his normal, sexual drive, to put it in those terms. And that's a very challenging idea. We spent a couple of days just trying to understand the psychology of it. And he was sort of saying he just couldn't have any more children. And that, see, you have to study different approaches, different pshat. A pshat can make sense on one level, but then there's problems from another one. Then another pshat will come along and solve that problem from that angle, but it has its own problems. So this, in terms of why Yaakov is telling him this, in this particular, in terms of context, I think it fits in very, very smoothly according to the Sforno. But the notion itself is like not so simple to grasp. And we struggled with it, that, okay, we understand sadness, we understand loss, we understand mourning, but that it should be of such a profound nature that he would completely. You have to say, of course, that according to this, it was simply impossible. And even though he had a prophecy from God that he was supposed to have another child, but he couldn't have another child. And thus, he has chosen the two sons of Yosef to be the congregation, so to speak, of nations, to fill up the number of tribes that was supposed to be. Okay, we struggled with that for a few days. I had my problems with it, given what takes place afterward with the incident of Reuven, where the Torah says that he lied with, slept with Bilhah, the maidservant, who subsequently was the concubine or the wife of Yaakov, and the rabbinical interpretation, which Rashi brings down, that it doesn't mean he actually slept with her, but he switched the beds. I got the sense from there that, because according to the, and that's the standard interpretation, that Reuven couldn't tolerate the insult to his mother because she was second fiddle to her younger sister, Rachel. And now that Rachel died, he expected that Yaakov would place his bed, I mean, on a permanent basis, in the tent of Leah. Instead, he placed it in the in the tent of Bilhah. That bothered Reuven very much, and he went and he switched the beds. And the Torah ascribes it as though he had slept with Bilhah, because he interfered with the marital life of his father. And for this, he lost the blessings that he was entitled to. My objection at that point was that this seems to imply that Yaakov continued to have a marital life, which would be contrary to the Sforno. And I got the sense that at least Jesse and Libby, I don't know who else, did not agree with me that the idea of placing his bed in a particular tent and this being a big disturbance to the fact that he switched it, it was a big disturbance, does not necessarily imply, you know, a sexual marital relationship, but rather he still had an emotional one. All right, that's hard to resolve. The Sforno obviously would agree with you. Of course, the Sforno, that's the interpretation that he gives, and he's aware of this phenomenon. And I sort of left it at that.
Rabbi Nass?
Yes.
Does the Sforno say anything about the incident where Reuven with Bilhah?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Let's take a quick look. Let's God does not offer his opinion as to what exactly Reuven did. That's the first thing that you really have to say. Do you take it literally or not? He doesn't have anything to say on that, but he does have something to say on verse 22. Vayishma Yisrael, which is Yaakov. Yaakov heard. And the sons of Yaakov were 12, which is a very strange, cryptic kind of a statement, because what does one thing have to do with the other? So the Sforno says, Afa pisha shoma, even though he heard, lo ipilo miminyan banav, he didn't remove him from the count of his sons. In other words, he did not disqualify him from being considered one of the 12 tribes. Kilo haya, interesting reason. Kilo haya safek etzlo, because there was no doubt, he had no doubt, sha'asa tshuva li'altar, that he did tshuva immediately. Okay. Lo nedar mi minyan b'nei Yaakov. And he was not removed from the count of the sons of Yaakov. Okay. The statement of the Sforno is, at the, you know, he had no doubt that he repented immediately. As a result, he was not omitted from the roster of the sons of Yaakov, who were destined to remain at the end of days and survive all the other nations. Now, let me just read to you the quote from, this is Rabbi Pelkowitz, who wrote a commentary on it. Let's see if that has anything that's relevant. Jacob's firstborn, Reuven, the Talmud in Tractate Shabbos explains that Reuven had defended his mother Leah's honor. Upon the death of Rachel, Jacob had taken up residence in the tent of Bilhah, and Reuven strongly felt that it was improper. And so he, quote, arose and transposed her couch, unquote. For this rash act, according to heavenly law, he was not guilty of any overt transgression. His father, however, had the authority and right, according to temporal law, that's human law, to impose a ban upon him for this action. Jacob did so on his deathbed when he referred to the incident and removed the birthright from Reuven. Hence, in our verse, the Torah correctly states that Reuven was the firstborn in accordance with heavenly law. But nonetheless, Jacob was justified when he punished him later in accordance with the law of man. The Sforno quotes the passage from Tractate Moed Katan to prove that a prominent scholar, in our case Jacob, has the power to pronounce a ban, and Reuven's demotion is considered to be, in a sense, a ban. Okay, that's basically what he's saying, but in my opinion, this doesn't help us in the least. He does not make any comment. He doesn't connect the two. That is that he doesn't seem to be connecting what he says later on about the fact that the death of Rachel had the effect of removing his Yetzer Hara with regard to women. And the fact that after she died, he planted his bed in the tent of Bila, which I sort of got this. And again, the deed, the disrespectful deed of Reuven, interfering, so to speak, with the marital behavior of his father. He doesn't see fit to make a statement and sort of clarify that and say, even though we learn later on that Rachel's death had this effect upon him, still in all, he retained the relationship with the women, but it wasn't based upon the sexual. He doesn't make that kind of statement. So it's not going to help us. I was thinking about this. I think it's time to move on. This is, you know, you just can't keep beating something to death. It boils down to a question of sense. What the sense that you get. I can't prove my position. I don't think you can prove your position. I think that the other position, that is that he still retained a special place in the tents, even though he didn't have sexual relations and so on, is, you know, it's reasonable. It's a legitimate position. I was just saying I got a different sense. I thought that story did raise an issue with the pshat of the Sforno. I think it's time to move on, because it was very interesting. We really got into something very new, but I don't think I can go much further at this point. See, that's the way these things are. Sometimes you arrive at an understanding not in the first attempt. You know, you can only go so far, and then you let go of it. And then sometime later on, for whatever reason, you get back into it, and now you have a deeper understanding. Of course, you've picked up some points elsewhere, or simply it just takes time to germinate and you get a better understanding. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't have much more to say on the topic at this point. I would just be rehashing what I already said. So I think it's enough. I think it was very fascinating. You know, the way we took out that pasuk, which is seemingly very, you know, kind of bland, doesn't seem to be that important. And we found that it was extremely important. And then we stumbled upon by accident, this Sforno, which we had never done before. I mean, Jesse, who's been with me since I started Masoret, so she didn't remember that we ever discussed this, or like I said, I wasn't even aware of it. And we discussed it, and that's it. I think it's time to move on. So we're going to have a little discussion about the makos. The first maka, as you know, was the blood, dam. Okay, so that was... And that was done by Aaron. So it was to strike, so to speak, the water in the Nile, and it would turn into blood. And the fish, all the fish will die. The river will become foul, you know, the odor. And the Nilu Mitzrayim, Lishdos Mayim in Ayor. And the Egyptians will become exhausted. That is, they'll try in vain, because that was their water supply. So this was a big blow to Egypt. And it wasn't just the Nile, because the next pasuk says, God told Aaron, take the staff and stretch forth his hand on all the water, basically all the water sources of Egypt, the rivers, the canals, ponds, reservoirs, wells, because it wouldn't make sense to just do it to the Nile. They had other sources of water, so it wouldn't make that much of an impact. So virtually all of the sources became, the water turned into blood. Let's assume it's blood. doesn't have to be. It could be something which is red and looks like blood. It doesn't matter. It's, well, what it means is that it's no longer drinkable. Then it says there'll be blood throughout the land of Egypt. Then it says in the wooden vessels and in the stone vessels, which means to say that even the waters that they had previously stored up in whatever types of vessels that they had, that too would turn into blood. But I think that there's a significance. This is a separate point. And that is that there's two ideas over here. One is that the water, changes. Its composition is changed, and it no longer can be drunk. Can't drink. It's not potable, as they say. But I think that there's an additional element in the blood. Of course, that makes an impact. Because, you know, water to a person, psychologically, he associates that with growth, with life. Blood has an association as well. So it's not just that you can't drink it, but the blood, it induces a certain feeling in the person. Because blood we associate with death. Bloody and so on and so forth. He bled to death. I think that's the psychological element of the makos is very significant. It's not just the physical. Okay, so then it says that they did this, and all the waters were converted into blood, and the fish died. And the blood, see, they keep mentioning that, Vahi Adam b'chol aretz Mitzrayim, that the blood was prevalent throughout the entire land of Egypt. Then it says that the Chartumim, these magicians of Egypt, they did the same thing with their secret devices. Because it wasn't a true miracle. They basically were good magicians, sleight of hand. Now, what's interesting, though, this is a side point. You could ask a logical question, and that is, where did they get water to do it with? If we're positing that all the waters in Egypt were already blood, now you're going to tell me that the Egyptians duplicated it, but then they would have to have regular water and convert it into blood. Actually asks this question. He says, if, you know, via the hand of Aaron, all the waters were turned into blood, so where did the Chartumim find water for them to do the same thing? So he says, the answer is that Aaron only converted the water which was on the ground. In other words, the waters that already were in the rivers, in the canals, and so on and so forth. Or we learn more than that, even in the vessels. But not the water that was beneath the ground. So in other words, I described it that there was an element of mercy. There was divine mercy in the plague. And the plague, of course, was intended for their benefit, to demonstrate the omnipotence of God. But God did not seek to deprive them. That's a serious thing. Because this lasted for 7 days. So I don't know how long a person can go without water. Although they had food. And there's there's water and food too. But still, I mean, people can get dehydrated if they just have food and not water. You need water. So what did they do? They had to dig. Because the underground sources of water that you would dig for were not contaminated. So he says that the Chartumim dug and they removed the water. And then they, whatever they did, was done with that water. Then he adds that there's a tremendous difference between what Aaron did and their actions. Well, yeah, because it's foolish to think that they duplicated. Because Aaron transformed all the waters that were in front of him and all the waters that were within the boundaries of Egypt. And also the waters that weren't, the waters that were moving, not only the waters that were still. Okay, and also that their miracle lasted for 7 days. Okay. And what they did was just brief, because it was sleight of hand. It wasn't a real. So there was a big difference between. So the effect was that, like I said in the this past week's Dvar Torah, it wasn't fatal. It was a tremendous. Well, the phenomenon itself is very disturbing. You can imagine. It's got to create a real shock if you wake up one day and all the water supply has, with no obvious cause, turned into blood. What they had to do was to dig. You know, they dug around and they would get water. So as I said, it wasn't, because it says in Pasuk Chavdal, the Yachbru comes Ryan's for Yusayor. Mayim Lishtos. They all had to dig around the Nile to get water to drink, because they couldn't drink from the water of the Nile. So there was a tremendous imposition and inconvenience, but it wasn't fatal. So let's see, what was the reaction of Paro? It does say that he had the magicians, whatever they did. And then it says, Vayifen Paro, Vayavo al Beso. Paro turned and he came to his house. Velo shas libo gamlazos. And he didn't pay attention even to this. I mean, even in conjunction with the, as opposed to the Taninim. Because this was worse than the Taninim. The Taninim was purely an abstract demonstration, but didn't have any effect on anyone. The snakes didn't harm anyone. That was purely for demonstration purposes. So he didn't have, he didn't have any stake in it. He could just walk away. But the blood, you'd think, would have a bigger impact. It was a much greater miracle, and it also had practical implications in terms of the harm it inflicted on his kingdom. But it says that Paro did not pay attention even to this. Now, the question I have over here is simply a few words. It says Paro turned and came to his house. Why does the Torah have to tell you that? I mean, that's like a fact. Of course he went to his house. Well, what else would we assume? He was there. He witnessed what happened. And he decided he's not going to give in. So he came home. I mean, that's like, at first glance, a very trivial piece of information. Yeah, and the Torah is not going to waste any space with that. So what's the significance of that? Okay, so let's turn to the second maka. The second plague is the frogs. And then he speaks to Paro again and repeats the warning. And you see how gentle Moshe was with him. In each case, he informs him in advance and he gives him an opportunity to avoid it. And it's only when he refuses that he proceeds. And then, as I wrote this past week, as soon as he relinquishes and says he's going to let them go, Moshe removes the plague. Even though there was no grounds to trust Paro, and why would he do that? Why wouldn't he keep the pressure on until he actually complied? But I wrote about that this week. So what happens next? He stretches again. This also involves the water sources, because that's where the frogs emanated from. Okay, and he brought up the tzvardim. Then it says, now listen carefully, because up to a point, Paro's immediate reaction was to see whether the magicians could do the same thing. And in Pasuk Gimel it says that the Chartumim, they did this with their magic. And they brought up Tzvardim on the land of Egypt. Now what happens next is strange, because it says that Paro called to Moshe and Aaron, and he says, entreat God, in other words, pray to God, that he should remove the Tzvardim from me and from my nation. And I'll send forth the nation, and they'll sacrifice to God. Then Moshe says, okay, you know, like boast over me. In other words, you pick the time. Like when? When should I, for when? When I entreat God, for when? So he's giving him an additional opportunity here. You just tell me the exact moment you want them to be removed. And he said, L'machar, tomorrow. And Moshe agreed. That's a separate question, which the Ramban asks, but I can't take it up now. And that is that, why would Paro, if it was so painful and he couldn't take it, when a person's in that state, he wants it removed immediately? Like, why would he want to wait till tomorrow? But basically, the Ramban's answer, quickly, is that Paro thought that maybe Moshe has a certain insight into why this is happening. In other words, that was part of the debate. Is this special miracle, or just that Moshe knows certain things about the natural order that we don't know? And if that's the case, he may know that it's going to end anyways. So therefore, he said no tomorrow. He was willing to endure that pain for an extra day in order to see if he could disprove Moshe. Okay. Now, the thing is, in the first instance, what caused Paro? What was the difference between the first and the second plague? In the first plague, it would appear that he got the magicians to do it, and once they did it, that gave him the stubbornness. Whether the magicians did the same thing as Moshe or not, but when a person doesn't want to give in to something, he'll just use that. So now in the second case, it mentions the magicians did the same thing. I mean, the way they did it, whatever, on whatever level, the magicians mimicked it. So therefore, you would expect that Paro is going to be stubborn because my magicians. So what's different? What's the difference between the first case and the second case? In the first case, the fact that the magicians did it was sufficient for Paro to be stubborn and refuse. In the second case, the magicians did it, but that didn't have the same effect on Paro. What's the difference? I wanted to say that the see, you never know when a phrase or so, or even a word in the Torah assumes great importance. I think going back now to the description of the first of the Dam, Pasuk Chav Gimel, Vayifen Paro Vayevo Al Beso. It says he turned and went to his house. Then it says that he didn't pay attention even to this. So the fact that he went to his house is really, really crucial. It wasn't just, so you had two things. It wasn't just the magicians being able to duplicate it. The idea of going to his house really meant an escape from reality. That is, you know, for many people, when they're facing things that are very, very painful, they come back to their house and they, you know, all of their furniture and all of the glory and everything he's got. So it's a different world. He's able to return to that world where he's the master. And because he was able to return to that world where he was the master and he could ignore the fact that he wasn't, that he didn't have control. So that's what enabled him to resist. He could escape from the reality. However, if you take a look at the second case, then it says that very specifically that what does it say? It says that the Tzfardim went up and covered the land of Egypt. One second. Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm sorry. It's really verse 28, which says, the river will swarm with frogs, and they will come up and enter into your house, into your bedroom, onto your bed, into your servants' houses, and into your people, into your ovens, and into your kneading bowls. The frogs will come up unto you, your people, and into all of your servants. So in other words, what's it telling you? That it's true that the magicians were able to do whatever they did, just like in the first case. But there was another ingredient, and that was he could escape. So that's what God took away from him. He couldn't escape. The second one was that even in the palace, that was his stronghold. And everything, the furniture, the ovens, every possible area was swarming with frogs. He couldn't prevent that. That's what broke him down. He had no place to escape to. But in the first case, it wasn't just that the magicians duplicated, and it wasn't just that he was able to get, his servants would get water that he needed, but psychologically he was able to return to his palace, and he had peace, and he was able to sustain the illusion of his greatness. But in the second case, that was broken down. He wasn't the king anymore. He couldn't even control his own bed, his own bedroom, and so on and so forth. So that's what caused him to give in. And even though the magicians, that was just something he used as an excuse, as a justification. But in point of fact, he was forced to recognize that what the Egyptians did was meaningless. What Moshe did was real, and it was impossible to resist. So that's why he was completely shattered. But the interesting point is, we'll just conclude with this point now, that he was willing to endure the pain for one more day. He didn't have to, because Moshe said, go ahead, glorify yourself. In other words, make a fool out of me. I'll let you pick any time. And if you do that, and I can't comply, you've won. You'll see that people will see I'm a fraud. So go ahead, you pick the time. He didn't tell him when. And because Paro was intent, he had this suspicion, he didn't want to recognize that Moshe was a genuine prophet, and he thought that maybe Moshe knows something that I don't know, so I'll do tomorrow. Because Moshe's expecting me to say right away. And Moshe himself knows that it's going to end anyways. So therefore, he goes till tomorrow. It's very, very interesting, because he's willing to endure this terrible pain, which is crushing him. But he's willing to put up with it for another day in order to, because of his stubbornness, rather than to confront the truth. That's how far gone he is. I would also add that you can learn, parenthetically, there's a psychological lesson. You can learn from here that there's a psychological element to pain. That is, when a person is experiencing pain, so it's the pain itself, and also he doesn't know when it's going to end. But sometimes if you know how long it's going to be, and then it's going to end, it's easier to endure a medical procedure and so on and so forth. So if the doctor tells you that I'm going to do this and it's going to hurt, so you're going to ask him, well, how long? So if it's a very long time, obviously, you may want some kind of anesthesia. But if it's not that long, then your mind focuses on that. You know that in, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, whatever it is, then it'll be over. So knowing when something is going to end, it's like Yom Kippur. Very few people really enjoy it. And, my whole theory is don't look at the clock. Forget about that. But, it's going to end. So the fact, if for whatever reason, we were told to start the fast, and we were not told when it's going to end, people would be going crazy pretty early in the day. When is it going to be over? Do you have any idea? When is it? That's all people will talk about. But now they talk about what time it is. How much longer do we have to go? Which is counterproductive. It's not productive. That's a different story. So the fact that he knew that it would end tomorrow made it tolerable, and he had the hope that he would have a victory here by making, ironically, unless it ended earlier, he'd have a victory, so then that enabled him to carry on.